There are people in Zimbabwe that can't feed their parents. There are people in their parents that can't feed themselves. And we need to stand up. We need to rise together and become one. We need to all put our hands together and clap, clap ferociously like it's a thunderstorm and welcome Mike Maxwell to the Inspired Disorder Podcast.
Welcome to the Inspired Disorder Podcast. Red Bull Podcasts inspired by life, love, stress, and setbacks. With your hosts Ray Taylor and Justin Kim. Disorder starts now.
It does start now. As it does from time to time. How you guys doing tonight? Justin King and our guest, Mike Maxwell.
What's going on?
Yeah. So, this is actually episode 50 of the Inspired Disorder Podcast, which is a milestone, right? Like, if we were talking for a mile, we would have passed this stone. So we're totally at 50 stoned, right? Isn't that right?
Pretty much. Yeah, it's a good analogy. I like that little thing you just whipped up there.
Yeah.
Pretty crazy, man. 50 episodes in.
50 episodes. So how are you doing tonight, Mike?
I'm fantastic.
Well, that's
how are you guys?
I'm doing good.
So far, so good.
Do we all sound fantastic?
I think we do sound fantastic. So for those listening live, you're welcome for the fantastic sounds of our voices.
I appreciate the intro. That was pretty awesome.
Yeah, I usually throw together, I get like audio from like whatever viral video or whatever the fuck I want in the beginning, and I couldn't think of anything, so I just like, you know, I just get to throw something together.
The personalized touch was classy.
Well, yeah, that's, you know, we're trying to make it personal around here. Like,
can the people on the interweb see me, or is it the skull image?
It's your Twitter icon.
It's my Twitter icon, looking tough and shit.
Yeah, you looking badass. So it's basically it's me, and then your Twitter icon. Like, it's like, if you don't like this shit, I'm gonna jiu-jitsu your ass and get you in a triangle or some shit.
Somebody made a snarky comment on my Twitter the other day. I did a tweet about if your handwriting looks like a five-year-old, I automatically distrust you, or I think you're an idiot or something. Something just judgmental. And somebody responded, I think, the same of people who wear wife beaters.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't even catch it at first, but then I realized that I'm wearing a wife beater in that Twitter icon.
Uh-huh.
And it was probably a direct connection with that. So it was a witty comment. But that photo was taken by Ben Grillo, tattoo extraordinaire. I think probably one of the best in San Diego, if not one of the best in the world in the tattoo world. He's been a guest on my podcast. And,
nice. Where does he work out of? Does he have his own shop, or is it he does like, you know, super legit like VIP?
Yeah. He tattoos all over the place. He travels a lot. He tattoos at Flying Panther down in Golden Hill area. Biovanitas' shop.
Sweet. Have you gotten tattoos from him before?
Yeah, he's done a bunch of tattoos on me lately. He did my finger tattoos, which is the little icon for my podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And the eyeball on my hand. He did a pine cone tattoo on me. He's like the king of little single needle tattoos.
Okay,
he's a magician. It's crazy.
That's awesome. That's one thing, man. I there's tattoos that I want to get, but I'm so sketchy about how, because I'm very particular about that kind of stuff. So it's like, I don't want somebody to fuck it up. But I'm also cheap and poor, so. It's a very horrible combination of things to go and get some unique tattoos done.
No, I hear what you're saying. I'm lucky enough that like a majority of the people who have tattooed me mm-hmm. are my friends.
Okay.
And we've worked out barter systems, or, you know, they just were like, here, let me tattoo you, or those sorts of things. So I've been lucky enough to have a bunch of really, really talented tattoo artist friends. So if it weren't the case, I would have zero tattoos.
Yeah. How long ago, when, how old was, were, just so everybody knows, Mike Maxwell, you are an artist.
I am.
If anybody didn't know that. And we're all, not that that's interchangeable, but we're all the same age about.
Right.
We're all in our 30s-ish, like early 30s. And so how old were you when you first got your first tattoo, got your first tattoo?
I think it was either my 19th or 20th birthday. My mom actually paid for it. And it was the Andre the Giant head I have on my wrist, which was a sort of homage to the time I had spent working for Shepherd Fairey. It's sort of right in the middle of that, actually. Okay.
So you got the Obey. Is it like?
It's actually the OG, like,
okay, the full head,
the posse sticker head, but it's just the head of the sticker. It's not the whole thing. It's okay. Like the face.
So how old were you? Okay, wait. So
I was 20.
Okay, but when? How did you start working? You said you worked for Shepherd Fairey.
Yeah, I started working with him like right out of high school, like 19. Mm-hmm. 20. I was his assistant for 2 years.
Okay.
And that sort of was like my art schooling, because I didn't go to art school. I dropped out of high school my senior year and just did homeschool and finish that shit real quick.
Yeah.
And then I like just started working like right away. But then I connected with him sort of through like the early street art movement. Like I was putting up stickers and posters around San Diego, like late 90s. And he ended up needing somebody to work for him, like doing like shipping posters and stickers and bullshit like that. And I ended up being his assistant for about, like I said, like 2 years, doing like all the shipping, taking care of all the Obey stuff, like all the big posters and shit that you'd see like on the streets around those times. Like I always had to go get those blown up. Mm-hmm. I was actually like, I modeled for one of the images, like one of the Zapatista images.
Uh-huh.
Is me dressed up like a, you know, South American Zapatista soldier with like the headgear on, but like, it's just from the, you know, waist up.
That is saluting. Sick. So yeah. Did you, how old were you when you started doing art? I mean, you must have been, I'm assuming you were just as long as I can remember.
Right. Yeah, forever. Like as long as, even I was told I was making things before I could remember making things, you know.
Yeah.
And it's hard to tell how much of that is like, you know, moms remembering old stories and sort of romanticizing them. But
yeah,
you know, like as soon as I could get something in my hand, I was making stuff. And like around 5 or 6, I did an oil painting with my grandfather. He's like a Bob Ross style paint, like landscape, like Happy medieval trees. California landscape painter.
Yeah.
And he and I did a painting together where we painted this landscape, and he would show me like, okay, this brush does this sort of thing, so try this. And I would do that. So we did a painting side by side.
Yeah.
And ended up doing two paintings over like a weekend or whatever. He had a little studio set up, and you know, that was like a instant love right there. And then my mom was always really good at drawing, like this real natural skill of being able to replicate nature and like portraits really well.
Uh-huh.
And I always strive to be as good as she was at making these things. And so that was a big inspiration of making stuff too. And I also got a lot of attention for it, like at a young age, like as if there was some sort of, like I got attention for the skill level. And so that always, like, of course, that made me feel good as a child, like getting that sort of attention. So it was like that sort of extra boost to keep making stuff that you know, at an early age, I knew I was going to have some sort of creative path.
Yeah. So you've been creative your whole life, and you didn't go to college for it, but did you take like art classes in middle school, high school, stuff like that?
No, it's funny. Like I talk about this a lot. Like I got kicked out of the only art class I ever took in high school. Uh-huh. The teacher wanted me to draw a shoe. You know, like they brought a bunch of shoes in and put them on the middle of the table.
Yeah.
and everyone had to do like a still life shoe. And I wasn't happy with the way the shoe was coming out. So like I morphed it into something else that I was happy with. And the teacher, he was like, if you don't draw the shoe, then I'm going to flunk you out of this class or something to that nature. And it was like, So as soon as I got told no, that I couldn't do something, I became rebellious. This is my nature. And it was like, well, fuck you. I'm turning this shit in. And then talk shit about it and ended up getting kicked out of the class. But I mean,
it's crazy.
It seriously, like I say this a lot, and it was at that particular moment that I realized that art was what I wanted it to be.
Yeah.
And no other person was going to dictate what it is that I made or could tell me that I was making something incorrectly or correctly, like that nobody has that power over me.
Yeah.
And I learned that like at that very moment and basically told the world to go fuck itself after that.
Well, that's always a good thing to tell the world, because I try to tell the world that all the time.
In the nicest of ways, with the best of intention, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, how many good ways is there to tell the world to go fuck itself? I know about three, but, you know.
Of course, it's metaphorical, you know, like.
Yeah. No, I actually, like lay down on the ground and it's like, fuck you, world. Go fuck yourself. Go get a volcano and stick a mountain in it and just, like, fucking bring him back and forth.
No, it's this idea that the world is yours, you know, like that Scarface idea.
For sure. And I don't know. It's like it's weird for me to talk to another artist, because I don't really associate like none of my friends. I mean, my friends are artists, like Justin's an artist, but it's not like nobody is doing like the fine art thing that I know that I hang out with. So, but for me, it was a little different. Like I was told, like my mom was an artist and I think she was just really jaded from being an artist. And so when I was young and I was creative, she's like, the only artists to make money are dead. So that's a little crushing for a child.
Yeah.
And then
it's not true though. It's not true.
It isn't. No, not at all. The only artists that don't know how to make money are just don't know. They there's a lot of things that they may not know.
But that said, I don't know that the rich artists are something worth like trying to achieve at.
Yeah.
You know, achieve too, you know, like the Damien Hirst and the fucking Jeff Koons of the world. Like, don't worry about being those douchebags. Like, just make what you want to make. And if it brings you some sort of joy, then, like I said, go tell the world to go fuck itself. Like, it's got to be about you first.
Yeah. And so then my thing was to be a photographer. So I got into photography and then, like, played around with that, and I wanted to be a photographer for National Geographic. But then I was like homeschooled for a little bit during like middle school, high school. And then I went back to high school and I couldn't get into the photo thing. So I got into the art thing. And I must've had like way more artistic teachers, I guess, because I was doing fucking crazy shit. Like they wanted to do a painting of a mask and I would do like this fucking crazy portrait of Einstein, like a surfer Einstein guy with sharks and surfboards around him, and they're like, oh, this is the best thing we've ever seen. So I don't know. It's I guess it would depend on how jaded your teacher is that were to tell you one thing or another, because I guess if my mom was a teacher, she'd probably be like way more jaded than whatever teacher I had at the time. But it's,
well,
like,
Mike, at what level of, I mean, as far as when this teacher told you to conform and like do that drawing exactly how, you know, he requested, were you like in like grade school still at this point? Was this like way back in the day?
Yeah, that was in high school. And, you know, in all reality, he's probably just trying to keep a class in order and get through his day. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
But he was one of those like weird, stereotypical, like hippie art school teachers. Not art school, but high school art teachers, you know?
Yeah.
Just as like, you know, it's a, you know, what's the, I can't even remember what it's not a required class, but one of the electives that you have to fulfill or whatever.
A coast.
I gotcha.
You coast through that shit.
Yeah, it was nonsense. Like people making bongs with the fucking,
yeah,
with the clay and shit like that.
Oh, yeah, that was middle school for me, man.
I mean, the reality is, and I probably made it into like me just like I was probably being a pain in the ass teenager looking back now. But, you know, I figured I was standing up for myself. But I took some sort of life lesson out of it at least.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Another thing, too, I wanted to ask you. You said you worked for a Shepherd Fairey for a little while there. Did you? I'm sure you saw through the gift shop documentary came out a couple of years ago. And I was going to ask what your thoughts were in that whole documentary and the whole situation there.
Yeah, I thought I was going to be in it because, you know, like a lot of people came around that time and were filming and doing weird things. Like at one point, a dude came and did like a video interview situation and went to Kinko's with me.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
To see how I got the posters because, like, I used to have like a scam at the Kinko's. Like, I had a number of different ways of scamming Kinko's back in the 90s. One was to like flirt with all the girls that were in there, you know, all the girls that worked in Kinko's, you like just, you know, flirt with them and then like bring skateboards and stickers for the dudes, like be cool with the dudes in there.
Yeah.
And I would basically go in there and get, you know, print out 30 of these big 8-foot tall posters, go up to the counter and be like, oh yeah, you know, I got, 10 square feet. And they would charge me like $3 and I'd be out of there. And I actually got incentives. So if I went there and scammed as many posters as I could and brought them back to the studio,
yeah,
I would get the money that it would cost to make the posters, mm-hmm, you know, nice, to a certain extent as a bonus. But, so like a guy came and watched me do all that. Like another one, do you remember, I don't know, this is probably old school for most people, but at Kinko's, they used to have the little, like counters that you would stick into the machines. Do you guys remember those?
No.
Hmm.
I never like had to use Kinko's until like 3 years ago. So,
well, they used to do this thing where they would have these counters that it was like a big square. It looked like a, like almost like a garage door opener type situation with a number counter on it. And you would stick it into the machine and it would count the number of copies that you made.
Okay.
Okay.
Before everything was all digitized. Right. So I would run, you know, like 300 or so, like 11 by 17 copies. And what you would do is that if you put the key, they would call them keys, if you put the key on the counter and then just kind of slid it off and let it fall and hit the ground by itself, mm-hmm, all of a sudden all the numbers would spin. So it would be like 200,600 whatever copies.
Yeah.
And I would go up to the counter and be like, hey, look, you know, like obviously I didn't get 275,000 copies. I was only here for 20 minutes. Yeah. I got 10 copies. Let me pay for this. And so like there was all these different ways to like just stick it to the man, otherwise known as Kinko's.
Yeah.
So a guy came with me and filmed this whole thing, this whole routine I would go through. And I thought that it was maybe that kid. But because at the beginning of the film was about around the time that I started working with him too. But I, in terms of the film, I thought it was shitty in terms of how it made the art world look. But I guess part, yeah, of that is just sort of the realization that it's not as cool as maybe I thought it was. Like it's a little more douchey than I may have actually gave. I knew it was douchey, but maybe more douchey, yeah, than I thought. And then the idea of like turning yourself into an artist to be this like cool hip trend is, yeah, fucking shitty as fuck. Like I'm not into that at all. And like, it's just kind of silly. But on the other hand, Banksy is hilarious. Like his, yeah, sort of mocking of the art world is hilarious. His sense of humor is top notch. Like it's really, everything he does is hilarious and it's skillfully done too. So, I mean, on that aspect, like I like everything, like the whole Banksy situation. But even then, like I'm not even that big a fan of like the street work that he does, except for the sort of comedic level. Like I don't think he should be getting. Actually, no, I'll take that. I was gonna say I don't think he should be getting paid the money that he does. But I mean, you know, more power to him. I guess he can get whatever kind of money he can try to. You know,
yeah,
but it's silly.
Sure.
People don't. People are. It shows how people buy a hype instead of like, a technical skill.
Well, I mean, if you look,
but that's
okay
too.
Yeah, if you compare it to like some bullshit that's on TV, like the Kardashians, it's like a manufactured fame type of thing. It's like not that they're on the same level. I mean, you know, Exit Through the Gift Shop was more. There's a lot more thought behind it, and I think the points that it tries to make aren't necessarily about like the street art movement or anything like that, but just in general, like most people consider artwork to be a highbrow kind of thing, whether it's street art now just because it's popular, or you know, tattoo art, or just regular fucking portraits and landscapes. I think the community at large kind of puts it on a huge pedestal of, you know, fame in some ways. I don't know. I love the movie, but it's insane that you were like so closely tied to that. So did Shepherd Fairey start in, I thought, is he starting in LA or Shepherd Fairey? How did you get hooked up with him?
No, he was in San Diego.
Okay.
We came out of Rhode Island School of Design. Okay. There's actually a film coming out about how he sort of got started. Some kids did a Kickstarter situation and got a film made. Yeah. But no, he was out here working with Dave Kinsey, another really good artist. So I was sort of under the tutelage of those guys. Like, I didn't realize it, but I was just sponging up information like all day. I actually almost moved to LA with those guys when they left San Diego, but I decided to stay here and actually did some other shit instead. And it was time for me to do my own thing at that point anyway.
Yeah. So how old were you when that all went down, when you were working with him?
Like 19 through like 21.
Jesus. It's insane. Yeah. So have you been consistently creating art like pretty much your whole life? There's never been any breaks or anything like that?
Yeah, as soon as, well, you know, like before that, I kind of saw myself as being like a comic strip illustrator or something. Like, I didn't know what I was going to do. Like, I knew I was going to be like, or like a t-shirt designer, like skateboard graphic type of designer or something.
Yeah.
But I saw these guys doing this fine art thing that was exactly what I had been doing, you know, sort of leading up to that, the few years leading up to that. And saw that there was a way to make a living doing it. Yeah. And so I just kind of jumped on board with the whole gang, and everybody was doing, like, San Diego during the late 90s was like this sort of weird art mecca that had built up, and people were doing all these, you know, putting together these really cool shows. Like, I was just talking to my last podcast guest about this show that we did. Like, it was Shepherd Fairey, Dalek, Rich Jacobs, a bunch of like really top name artists now that we were all just like skateboard punk rock kids just making our own thing happen. And like I got an opportunity to show with like a bunch of skateboard legends with the working with Modart and the Keep Abreast people at it, you know, right around that time. So like I saw this opportunity to keep making things and being able to get paid for it, and, you know, opportunities to travel and really make a name for myself. But that's not to say, like, at the same time, like, leading out of that, I was doing, you know, like, I worked for a magazine. I did a full apprenticeship doing tattooing. Like, I had saw myself getting into tattooing, but as soon as I did a full apprenticeship tattooing, like, I was starting to tattoo already, and I realized that I would much rather be at home in my studio doing what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And got out of that. But yeah, I've always been creating something, and since around that time, like 21, I've been making things available for people, so it's sustained me this entire time.
Nice. So which I don't know how many people know, but you're also into jiu-jitsu, which you've been doing for like about a year now.
Yeah, I just hit my this Saturday was my 1 year mark of training at the Noguera gym in San Diego.
Nice. And so what led you into that?
A few things, like listening to Rogan was definitely a heavy influence into doing that. Particularly, I had one of my early guests on the podcast, Sergio Hernandez. He's now a brown belt under Barrett Yoshida. He had told me, he was like, yeah, come down and train with me at some point. We can do like a free week or something. Uh-huh. You can check out how it is, see if you like it, whatever. And so I said I would do it. And then I did it. I said it on record, you know, like on the podcast. So like I felt this need to do it. Yeah. Well, it turns out that it wasn't sort of within my time frame and within my reach to go train at his gym in particular. So the Noguera gym happened to be accessible to me. So I started I took a free week there just to, you know, to go see how everything was, and fell in love as soon as I started.
Nice. So do you just train? Have you competed at all?
I haven't competed yet, but, you know, it feels like you're competing every day, and every day you're in there training, because, you know, you go, we do basically spar three rounds at least at the end of every class. But it's definitely something I want to do. I need to get my weight down. It's the number one thing. And the reality is I'm kind of old. I started pretty late at 32. Mm-hmm. And my body, it's rough on the body starting out, you know, in this first year, like getting my muscles in shape. I'm actually, next week is going to be strength and conditioning week. And now that I said it on the podcast, I actually have to do it. So like, fuck with me on Twitter or on Facebook. If I don't mention that I did at least one strength and conditioning class, but no, I definitely got to do that. Cause my, like it's definitely straining on the body. Yeah. Especially after going on trips and, you know, drinking a lot and eating good food, it's hard to get back into training.
Yeah. Fucking, I can only imagine. That's awesome, dude. That's something that I've wanted to do, but I just don't have any fucking time. I really don't have any time. I wish I did, but.
Well, come do it. You can come train at my gym. Like, just do a free pass day and check it out.
Yeah.
No, and I get hooked and then figure out how to find time.
Yeah. Maybe, yeah, I don't know. I should do that. How long is a class usually?
About an hour.
Okay.
And I mean, if you're, you know, I know you're in the East County, right? I'm a ex East County hood.
Yeah.
The Dominic Cruz's gym is right there by Gillespie Field off the 67.
Uh-huh.
And that place is just as good to train at if you're looking, you know, I'd prefer you come train with us, but if it's more within your reach to train there, I would recommend training there as well. And also there's another gym, I'm not sure what part of the East County you're in, but there's another gym on Hamishaw that one of the teachers at my gym also trains jiu-jitsu over there too. So
yeah,
San Diego Fight Gym or something.
I'm right off Hamishaw.
Dude, yeah, where you're like on Hamishaw, basically.
I could walk to Hamishaw right now and be back in time to talk some more on the podcast.
Gary Padilla trains jiu-jitsu and wrestling, so you could do no-gi, so you don't have to invest in anything. You just wear gym shorts and a t-shirt or a rash guard or something.
Damn it, Mike Maxwell, how dare you? How dare you fucking encourage me to do shit?
Man, you'll love it. I'm telling you.
I know I'll love it. I'm a huge, like, okay, how long have you been a UFC fan? When did you start watching UFC?
For over a decade. I was watching UFC. I watched, in fact, my buddy's dad, I think, got the second UFC, the one that Tank Abbott knocks that big Samoan out.
Okay.
It was the second or third one. Yeah, he got the HBO pay-per-view.
Okay.
So I've been watching since then, but I've also been watching Pride, and, you know, I watch Bellator and all that one. Was that one fighting where they had like teams?
I know what you're talking about. I can't
Lead XC what, and all that. Yeah, like that. For at least over a decade, and seriously, over the last year since I've been training, it's like watching a brand new sport.
I bet. I can only imagine. And when I do this. Apparently, I will know what you're talking about. I've watched all the UFCs pretty much, but I haven't. I only started like fucking 4 or 5 years ago, and then it's just been like catch up. But it's always been like UFC because a girlfriend I had out when I moved out to San Diego, she's like, you need to watch this, and we went to Blockbuster and rented some early UFC back when it was, I mean, I didn't know anything when she showed it to me. And, it was like a super early one where it was, you know, crazy. It was not anywhere as technical as it is right now. It was just like, it was like a sideshow act. And I wasn't totally into it, but then a few years later, I was like, I started looking up like fights online, like just backyard brawl type things and fucking, you know, cholos going at it. And yeah, it led me to download some, acquire some UFC fights. And from there, like I got, I think it was like, it was in like the 50s or 60s, UFC 50s, 60s or something like that. And I was like, oh, and it had gotten to a level where I'm like, whoa, this is so complex and so mind blowing. And then I just like, okay, I need to watch everything I can get my hands on or my eyeballs on. And I don't know. It's one of those things where, especially now, and you know, listening to the Joe Rogan podcast, it's like they're always talking about it, and it seems so, you know, for old guys like us, you know, it'd be more likely to go do jiu-jitsu than it would be like Muay Thai or boxing or any, you know, or even wrestling. It seems like jiu-jitsu seems like the perfect kind of entry into anything that they're doing.
Yeah, because there's a technical skill that's taken place that's impossible to relate to unless you experienced it personally. Like, yeah. I use the analogy of like skateboarding. Like, people could look at skateboarding and appreciate it for what it is, but unless you've like felt what it's like to kickflip downstairs, like, you don't really know what that experience is, you know. And I got tweeted by the new, or like a tweet response from the guy, the new Fox announcer.
Uh-huh.
But do you know his name? Can you remember his name?
I can't remember it offhand. But he looks like a smaller version of Joe Rogan.
Yeah, he. I guess he was talking to Dominic Cruz, asking him what he could do to be a better fight announcer.
Uh-huh.
And he told him to go and watch like real high-level wrestling footage.
Uh-huh.
And I told him to start training jiu-jitsu.
Yeah,
and apparently he said he was going to go. He said he had already bought a gi and was going to do it. And so it's like, it's seriously like, I wonder sometimes when people watch the UFC with me if it's annoying or if it's informative, because like I'm yelling out all the like moves that are happening and what should be like the next situation, even though, you know, I'm clearly not a fighter. I'm just a jiu-jitsu player.
Yeah,
but like, I'm, you know, I'm just screaming all the like action. Like, I'm like, I self announce it for some reason, especially at like going to the events. Have you ever been to a fight event?
No, not yet. I really want to try and get tickets in July. They have the UFC Expo. I really want to try and get tickets for that. The fight that's on that Saturday. It's the Uriah Faber versus Dominic Cruz, and then Forrest Griffin versus Tito Ortiz, which I'm a huge Forrest Griffin fan. I think he was
where
like,
is that?
It's in Vegas in like July 6th or 7th.
Dude, you got to get me a ticket too, Ray, if you end up getting tickets for that shit, because you know I want to go too. We're still talking about beating up out there, right?
Yeah.
For 4th of July, right around that time?
Yeah, for sure. I'm going to the UFC Expo that weekend. We're going out. I think we're going to be there Thursday. I think it starts. It's like a 3-day expo, and then the night of the last day is the UFC fights. And I really fucking want to go, but it's, you know, getting tickets and all that kind of shit. I really wanted to go. John Jones fought out here. I think it was Matyushenko. He fought. I can't talk right now, but Matyushenko and John Jones fought out in San Diego in the sports arena, and I super wanted to go, but it's always like fucking day job or money or just tickets are sold out. It's so hard to fucking plan everything, but I'm already going to be out there, and I don't care how much money it costs. I just want to try and get tickets for that. I haven't gone to see one yet, but I really want to. And I know what you're talking about as far as like commentating. As far as like for me, like being a new person watching it, listening to Joe Rogan talk about like commentate on fights, he's like the most educational fight commentator ever.
Yeah, he's the best.
So like that was a huge, huge advantage for me coming up and just learning what I'm watching, just listening to that. And now I've watched so many things. It's like, I'll notice things that the other guy should be doing, or I'll understand exactly for the most part what they're doing on the ground or on the feet. Like it's, you know, become, I anything I'm interested in, I get addicted to, and then I have to learn everything or as much as I can about it. So, you know, it's, I'll do the same thing where I'm watching a fight and, you know, I'll be watching with my girlfriend or whatever, and I'll be standing up and like torquing my body back. Like, have you ever played, you know, playing video games when you were a kid, like playing
like
Mario Brothers?
Power Glove on.
Yeah. Playing Mario. No, not even with Power Glove, just playing Mario Brothers with the old Nintendo controller. And then like every time you jump, you like move your hands over as if it were like if in the 80s there was this motion control technology. It's like I'm that way when I watch fights.
No, you're trying to like somehow fucking control that person through like telekinesis through your soul or some shit. You know,
exactly.
It's like that kind of level.
Yes.
That's when the stoner tangent. I apologize.
It's okay. No. Yeah. Wait. What? But it's that's what I feel like, especially during like big fights where I'm nervous about it. Like if John Jones fights, he's like, I remember watching him against God damn it, American Psycho, Stephen Bonner. Like, yeah. That was the first time I saw John Jones, and I was like, holy fucking shit, this guy is doing this to Stephen Bonner. So when I see John Jones or, like, GSP or just, like, you know, fighters that I'm a fan of, I get super stressed out. And then my body, I can't stand up. I have to, like, morph and move and adjust as if, I know what the fuck I'm doing.
I saw GSP backstage in Atlanta Greg Jackson and whatever the boxing coach, the striking coach that they have. I forget his name. He's like an Arab dude.
Yeah. I can't think of his name.
That shit was crazy. Watching John Jones fight in Atlanta. That's the first time I'd seen him fight in person. I watched the Rashad and Phil Davis fight in person.
Really? What did you think leading into this, the John Jones Rashad fight? What did you think as far as the fight and like the players leading up to it? What did you think of Rashad and the Phil Davis fight, or just Rashad in general in his fights?
Well, I've never really been a Rashad fan in the past, and I didn't think that any of his spectacular wins were against that spectacular opponents.
Agreed.
He dominated Phil Davis. Like, it didn't look it was an equal match. Like, Phil Davis wasn't ready. Like, he needed a couple more fights, I think. Yeah. But like I use this analogy that when I was at that fight, John Jones was doing announcing for Fox. Uh-huh. During that particular fight, but during, you know, that they, it was in between fights that they were talking.
Yeah.
And he was out on this, they had this little area, the stadium, sectioned off for them, right? Okay. Whatever.
Yeah.
And I looked over and it looked like he was sitting up on a perch, like a bird of prey, watching mm-hmm. two rodents like fight in the cage, just waiting to see which one he was going to eat next, you know?
Yeah.
But he didn't look like that vicious, opponent in Atlanta. Looked very calculated. Well, he's always calculated, but he looked very, very cautious.
Yeah.
There was none of the flash. We didn't, besides like the standing elbows, which he could do because he has reach. Like, we didn't see like a few spinning back kicks and a few spinning elbows, but really nowadays that's not all that spectacular.
Yeah.
We didn't see that typical like John Jones domination. Which, you know, isn't all that surprising either. Like, maybe, you know, we see him turning into a fighter who wants to be able to have a long career and not he obviously didn't want to make any mistakes, which a fighter never wants to make mistakes. But
have you seen the fights since then, or have you only seen them live? Did you rewatch the fights?
No, I haven't. Okay. I haven't seen the Atlanta card yet. I usually get him at the gym.
Okay. Because when I watched it, like low quality. It was very choppy during the main event. But I rewatched them last night. And I knew John Jones was throwing elbows. But it was like he was throwing elbows like GSP throws jabs. Like that. I mean, yeah. He has that kind of reach. But it was... I didn't, when I first watched it, I didn't realize how dominating those elbows were and how much he was, like, how clean those were going through.
Yeah, and there was those four or five that were up against the fence or whatever that kept getting through. It was like, why are you letting him keep elbowing in the face, stupid?
Yeah, yeah. And I totally agree with you, because that's one of the things that I was thinking and saying up until this fight. It's like, Rashad Evans, aside from him catching Chuck Liddell and, you know, catching certain people, he does not look impressive when he's in a battle. Like, he's never looked impressive. So,
well, I mean, that said, he has good striking.
Oh,
he's
yeah.
a good boxer.
Totally.
Good. Like, he dominated Rampage. Obviously, Rampage was on his way out.
Yeah.
That fight against Tito, he destroyed Tito.
Yeah. But even then, it's like, those aren't, at
right,
the time he
saying.
Fought him, they weren't high level guys. So it's like, you know, yeah. I mean, Rashad is like totally cream of the crop. But when you compare his fights versus Jon Jones fights,
well,
it's like,
if you do, you look at who he fought. He fought Rampage.
Yeah.
He beat up Rampage in a more dominant fashion. But I mean, he beat up an older Rampage who was hurt and didn't look, he was overweight.
Yeah.
He didn't want to fight that fight.
Yeah.
He fought Shogun. Who uh-huh. Shogun is like hit or miss. Like, you see, we see him get dominated. Like, Forrest Griffin whooped his ass, you know, and that you like, so sometimes, like, it's like, who's going to show up with him? And he did not look like he was ready to fight either when he showed up for that fight.
Yeah.
Then you have, who we were just talking about, I always forget his name too, the American Nightmare.
Oh,
Stephen Bonner.
Stephen Bonner, yeah.
Let's be honest. He's in
totally.
His mid-30s and on his way yeah. out. So the reality is
that's true.
Even though he's totally dominated coming through, mm-hmm. like the level of opponents in there aren't matched up equally. Like
yeah.
he's not even like – he should be fighting heavyweights almost, you know?
Yeah, he's almost there. But I mean, when he started, he was pretty small. Like, when he fought Stephen Bonner, he was pretty scrawny. And like, his stand up, if you watch that, is like sloppy fucking crap.
Yeah, he hit Stephen Bonner in the back of the head, and that's gonna, if anybody who's been hit in the back
yeah.
of the head before knows, that rattles your whole situation. It's
yeah.
gonna make for a tough fight, especially a humongous swinging elbow like
yeah.
his, like a full 360 degrees to the back of your head is gonna
no shit.
It's gonna ruin your fight. Chances. I mean, and that's not to take away, he's a super dynamic, like, people don't know what he's gonna do.
Yeah.
He makes weight, you know, like, more power to him.
Yeah,
you know, but I don't know who's gonna beat him. I think have they said who has the next opportunity? Oh, Dan Henderson.
Yeah, Hendo is the, which, you know,
he was
what
on
do
my
you
flight
think?
Back from Atlanta.
What do you think about Henderson about and
well
Jones?
I think he's got good wrestling, but I don't
yeah.
think his striking is going to be good enough. He could throw a bit. He's like, it's like Rashad.
Yeah.
You're just hoping for a big overhand right to
yeah.
connect. I mean, Rashad hit Jon Jones with that head kick.
He did. Yeah. He hit him a couple times. I think he hit him with an overhand and he hit him with a kick.
It was interesting to see it go five rounds.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. That was the first time one Jon Jones went five rounds and he got tagged a couple times. He never looked like super wobbled, but you could tell that he had to like get a little bit of breathing room. I think after like the end of the first round he got tagged and he went into his corner and kind of get like the oh this is a fight now, like
but you know, that card had a bunch of other really really good fights on it, like the
yeah,
Rory McDonald fight.
Yeah, that kid is a savage.
He's a beast,
man.
And all weekend leading up to that, like, Rogan was talking about how great Che Mills that,
yeah
I think I'm saying his name right?
I think so, yeah.
Che Mills, like how great Che Mills is and how like badass of a fight. And he put up two Che Mills.
Yeah, and he was saying that during the commentary of the fight that like he was, you know, it's like most of you guys don't know who Che Mills is. He,
yeah.
he, you know, he's a badass. He's like top flight competition. This is going to be a real test for Rory McDonald, even though you've never seen Che Mills fight. And then, like, when Rory stepped it up and, like, was just, like, vicious, like, connecting hard on every ground and pound strike, it was like, Joe's like, I don't know what to tell you. This is, he is a really hard person to be doing this to. So Rory is a fucking savage. And that was insane. And it was nice to see Matt Brown, you know, fucking battle it out and grind out a win. Cause he's one of those like blue collar fighters that I like.
Yeah, that was one of the more entertaining fights of the night. I thought the other guy, the karate guy, I thought he hurt his Wonder leg Boy. During the fight at some point.
I think he just got gassed, man. I think one, he was nervous that he wasn't able to, because it's only his second fight in the UFC, right?
Yeah.
Pretty sure. And
then coming off that big knockout.
Yeah.
The last one.
Yeah, his last fight, it was super quick. He threw a crazy karate head kick that the guy didn't see coming. So I think he had a little bit more confidence than normal coming into this.
His jiu-jitsu sucked.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. His takedown defense, I mean, was horrible. But I think it was a combination of him like just inexperienced, and then also I don't think he's used to, it didn't seem anyway, that his kicks gassed. Like his legs, I think he was just so confident in his kicks.
I noticed he started, if you go back, I haven't seen the fight on the video, but if you go back, I want to look myself. His normal stance was,
uh-huh.
He switched it around round, like middle of round two. He stopped, let's say he's southpaw. I think he's southpaw. He switched to a normal stance at some point and stayed there more often. It almost seemed like he couldn't put pressure on one of his legs. But
maybe.
I asked Rogan about it. He said that nothing happened. But I got to look back. It seemed like he switched. And I made mention of that during that. But
yeah.
Another one was the Rothwell fight with Brandon Schaub. Like Rothwell was in great shape. In comparison to all his other shit, but you know, his jaw looks suspect as he gets wobbled. But you know, Brandon Schaub was at the late show at Rogan's show in Atlanta.
Okay. All right. So maybe he partied a little bit too much that night before?
I don't know, man. I don't know.
Like, dude,
I figure the event was really late in Atlanta.
Which event? The fights?
Yeah, it ended at like 1:30 in the morning out there.
Well, they start normal I think they plan it all for West Coast, except for the last fuel fights. They were like at 3 PM. That fight, Rothwell looked in amazing shape, but he definitely took way too many punches to the head. He can take a fucking punch. But he took way too many punches to the head, and then Schaub. Yeah. I think Schaub I don't think he realized the chin that Rothwell had, and he was just trying to go in and try. He thought he had him rocked and was trying to go in and finish it, and Rothwell just clipped him with, I think it was a left hook that clipped him. He missed with like an uppercut, and he hit him with a left hook, and just like. You know, Schaub was out and was in slow-mo after that. So
yeah, I don't know if his head is big enough to be a heavyweight.
Yeah,
I wonder if he should lose some of that body mass and move down.
Because he's a former NFL guy, so, you know, he's... And they were talking about how fast he is. Like, for heavyweight, he's a really fast guy, which, you know, you better be if you're that light for heavyweight. But, yeah, I think... I don't know if he can, man. I don't know how much he carries around... I mean, he's not super thin in heavyweight, but it's hard to tell with those guys sometimes.
What else is I picked Eddie Yagan to win the fight over Hominick as well.
Oh, which one was that one?
It was the Mark Hominick fight. The guy he got knocked out his last fight, and the fight before that he fought Jose Aldo and got that lump on his head.
Didn't he get? He got knocked out in Japan, right? This like a straight right or something like that.
Yeah, ran right out and got caught.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Wait, hold on.
He was like a 6-1 favorite to win that fight,
uh-huh.
And he lost the decision against the little Filipino guy.
Hold on, I'm trying to find. Who did he fight again?
It was Eddie Yagan and Mark Hominick.
Fuck, I can't remember. Oh, Eddie Yagan, Mark Hominick.
Hominick got dropped by some big dude. Just throws bombs.
Yeah. For some reason, I can't remember that fight. I don't know. I probably will if I fucking saw it. again, but I just watched them last night. That's how good my brain works. One night away, and I totally don't even remember.
There's one coming. The next card is on Fox. Yeah. Free card on Fox with Jim Miller and Nate Diaz.
Nate Diaz. You know what? What's your thoughts on Nate and Nick? Or Nick, what's your thoughts on Nick and his last performance and what happened after that?
Well, I'll tell you, I had Nick Diaz winning that fight against what's his
Condit.
Fucking name?
Condit.
Yeah, against Carlos Condit. I had him winning that decision.
Yeah.
I think he's a great fighter, and I used to hate on him, like he was like I didn't like his attitude or whatever. But now I think he's rad. I'm into it. I think it's hilarious. True. And he's a really good fighter, man. Like,
oh, totally. I don't know, man.
I think he could beat GSP too.
I think that would be an amazing fight. I just want GSP to come back. I think he needs better competition, which Nick would, or Nate, which I don't know which one.
Nate's the lighter one, the younger brother.
Okay, so Nate would be, I think it would be a good fucking fight. I just want, you know, I don't know. I think Condit shouldn't be a bitch and just should not wait for GSP and go in and fight. Just do a rematch, you know. It's like, let GSP heal up, whatever. He's going to be fucking rusty, most likely. I mean, he's a professional, you know. Yeah. But I don't know, man. It's, I don't know. With that whole thing, I liked him a lot. I liked Nate a lot. If I'm talking about the right one, I always get him mixed up.
He's the skinnier one. He's sort of more light-skinned, I guess.
Yeah. You know, I liked him in the fight. And Condit didn't really throw a whole lot of stuff, but it seemed like he was busier. But whatever. I think how he handled his loss in that fight was a little bitchy. Like he seemed like he complained and he had excuses for stuff, which is fine. And I don't know. It's kind of a shitty situation, but I lost a little bit of respect for the guy. And I think his little brother is doing way better right now. I think he's on fire, and I think he's going to fucking dominate his next fight. Because he's just like, his strikes, he's got like the same like crazy, wide, fluid, like, I don't give a fuck. But he's connecting on shit with like, he's on a run right now.
Yeah, it's going to be a good fight. Jim Miller is a beast. I just went back and watched his fight. I posted on Facebook his fight with Charles Olivier, whose sort of body shape is similar to that of Nate Diaz, like lanky jiu-jitsu guy.
Yeah.
And but you know, those guys have such good, the Diaz brothers have such good boxing too.
Yeah. I don't know, but the Miller brothers are fucking, they're dogs, man. They're fucking in it to win it. So that'll be a good battle, you know.
Yeah.
Millers and so we'll
is
see.
The podcast usually this UFC heavy? Do you think
I don't really care. We talk about whatever. If there's somebody on, because Justin watches. Justin, you're still there, right?
I'm still here. Okay, I'm listening.
Ahead. Yeah, we all watch it. I'm a bigger UFC fan than Justin. I'm slightly addicted. You know, I have to shoot myself up with some UFC every once in a while just to feel normal. But there's no rhyme or reason to what we talk about. It's just just conversation.
Dude, you should definitely go when you're in Vegas.
I definitely want to try and go.
Say what?
What was that, Justin?
I was going to say, I do watch the UFC. I've been watching since UFC 100, so I do know a little bit about it. I'm just nowhere near the level of knowledgeability as where Ray's at and where you're at, too, from what I hear.
Well, from even heard, just, like, I could say. Going to the events, like, it's a brand, like, there's a different energy in there. It's weird.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely. I've been to, you know, football games, NASCAR races, and it's like, sure. It's not the same, you know. It's like, when you're there, it's just a whole different experience. And there's a lot of factors that go into that, but TV can only do so much, you know.
Well, I can say, as far as TV's concerned, I love watching football. I like watching basketball. I used to be huge into basketball. I used to play basketball. I used to watch basketball, all that shit. But everything's boring now. Like, when I watch UFC, like, I watch boxing, I watch anything else, except for, like, K1. If I watch some K1 shit, that's pretty exciting. But everything else is, like, super boring. Football is, like, the closest thing to, like, watching MMA for me now. So, you know, I don't know. I can't help it.
When I'm golfing, I like watching golf.
Yeah, you know what? I I watch it not. I watch it when it's on, and it's like, and I even got some clubs because there's people I work with, and they're like, "Oh, we're gonna do golfing." I was supposed to be in like a golfing tournament, and I golfed like once when I was like 10. So I got some clubs, and the tournament never happened. And I went to the range like twice. I could hit the shit straight, but I was like fucking trying to smack the shit out. So I was like throwing my shoulders out. I was at probably horrible form. But technically, golfing, I can see that being addicting. But I don't know.
That was my obsession before I found jiu-jitsu.
Yeah. So yeah. How long had you golfed before jiu-jitsu?
Just a couple years. Well, okay. when I started, I started in my late 20s, and I had never really golfed before that. But so now it's been a few years, but I haven't played in a long time. I've been meaning to go out.
Yeah.
You ever done disc golfing, Mike?
Yeah. You know what's really funny is something good for people who suffer from some carpal tunnel issues. Like, I draw a ton. So I've had moments where, like, I've got cysts in my wrist, like where my hand connects to my arm. And, you know, like it gets to where you don't have any range of motion in it. And one time I had a really bad carpal tunnel, like, you know, outbreak or whatever the fuck you want to call it. And I went, my buddies were going, and I was like, fuck, I'll go with you. And actually playing disc golf cleared up whatever the situation was in there. Nice. But it's funny, I have a friend of mine and a collector of my paintings who is like hyper disc golf fanatic. Like,
It's crazy, man. People don't realize there's like a whole professional league out there. There's the PDGA, and you know, they have like, you know, you have your driver discs, your putter discs. It's pretty crazy. I mean, I'm definitely a fan, but I'm not like into it to that kind of level. But
well, I'll tell you what, I call golf real golf, and
yeah,
and disc golf is disc golf. But that's fucking with people who are hyper into disc golf. It's cool. There's a few places here in San Diego, like I played the Balboa Park.
The Morley Field, yeah, man, for sure. Yeah, actually, I have a little personal like website thing I started up for. It was a for a school project actually, but you know, it's up there, it's working for anybody out there listening who are like looking for disc golf, like kind of like an overview of the game, where to play, and all that shit. Go to discgolfsd.com. Something I threw together for the shit of things.
You're super into it, then.
Yeah. I'm not like super into it. It was mostly just because, like, you know, we had to pick a project to make a site about for this thing I did for school, and you know, just looking around disc golf sites, I mean, there's nothing really for disc golf in San Diego. It's like if you search disc golf, it's like you get like, you know, all the main disc golf brands. That's about it, pretty much. So I want to kind of get some started where people in the area, if they wanted to get started and kind of get going with the sport, they can go. It's like a one-stop shop. They can learn about the sport, figure out where to go, you know, a little bit about how to actually play it and the whole nine yards. So
yeah, man, all that stuff is good. Whenever people find something that can go out and find themselves in the present moment, like, I'm all for it. As much as, like, anybody goofs on anything, like, if you could find something that really, like, especially something that gets you outside, getting some vitamin D, getting a little exercise,
definitely,
having some fun, like living in the moment, not worried about your past or your future. You're just throwing a disc at a basket, or if you're hitting a ball towards a hole or whatever it is, it's sort of just putting you in a good state of mind. Like, I'm all for that shit.
It's all therapeutic, man, for sure.
Yeah, indeed.
For sure. So did you play any other sports growing up, Mike?
I did football and stuff when I was young, like, but as soon as I got like junior high school, I was rebellious, man. I wasn't about to have some asshole yelling at me, telling me what to do, you know? So I rebelled pretty early and got out of there. But I played Pop Warner football and baseball and all that shit. Like, and I'm still like, I'm interested in those sorts of things, but, I find one at a time. I like bowling a lot.
Fuck yeah, man. Bowling is awesome.
Bullets of shit.
There's a place by my house that does dollar games.
No way.
All day, all week. That I can just go in there and just hang out with old people for an hour or two. It's awesome. And then it's usually like old people and then like the special ed kids from a class. There's always like four lanes of special ed kids, and they're awesome. Like having such a good time, it like reminds me to have a better time.
You gotta tell us where this place is, man, because we're all San Diego ones here. You gotta let us know where's it at.
Oh, dude, I don't know if I could let my
it's a secret. Yeah.
But you can
tell us later.
I'll do some research.
Yeah, I remember I used to go bowling all the time back in the desert. I grew up in the Coachella Valley. And Bermuda Dunes.
Well, that's right. Ray's not a San Diegan. Never
I'm
mind.
Not a. Well, I've lived here for like a decade, so. But
doesn't count.
Yeah, whatever. Fuck you. I used to go bowling at Palm Springs Lanes. Palm Springs. Whoop whoop. Fuck you. Anyway, so and I remember there's this one guy that used to come in all the time, and he was like he had Down syndrome or something like that, but he had like this crazy underhand throw for his bowling ball, strikes yeah. every time. Is fucking amazing.
I used to sometimes I would go up to the line and find the grooves in the wood planking
yeah.
leading down there. And it would actually, you know, the grooves would actually take a little bit of the level of the field of the lane down. Mm-hmm. And if I would just set the ball down as close to the center as I could on whatever like grain was available to me, like the splits between the wood pieces,
yeah.
and just push it like a straight, just giving it momentum, enough momentum to get down there, like not trying to direct it or anything. And sometimes it would stay right, like you could see it wobble, like try to get off of that particular groove. And you know, it's probably like at the end of a day when it's been used a bunch or whatever, but like it would actually roll down and stay on that line, like try to bump off but stay on there. And hit the head pin every time. But, you know, it wasn't a very
so,
high-scoring way to go about
so
it.
So what you're saying is that you hacked bowling.
Yeah, sort of. That's what it felt like for a few moments. But then whenever you feel like you figure something out,
yeah,
that's usually when it takes a fucking left turn on you. And then you're like, oh, shit, that didn't work.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I remember because we tried to do the backhanding underhand like we're throwing a yo-yo fucking bowling technique, and it worked a couple times. They're like, fuck, we figured out a secret. And then it stopped working. And
that, yeah, you know. I think about that, like I have a secret for playing roulette, like a sort of pattern that has a tendency either to win a bunch of times in a row or not somehow. Yeah. But whenever I go to Vegas, if I want to drink for a while
and yeah.
just have some fun and play at a table, if I go to a blackjack table, I'll eventually double down on everything and lose all my money. But I have this little pattern that I could sit down at a roulette table and maybe either win $50 or lose $50, like one way or the other, but sit down and have like six beers or something, you know, and have yeah. fun.
Definitely. Roulette's the shit, man. Roulette's by far my favorite table game. So
it's so fun.
Love
it's
man.
Terrible odds, but it's
terrible odds. It's just, yeah, I love the new style of the tables too, where those little screens that are up there so you can kind of like follow the numbers around and follow like if it's red or black and kind of, you know, judge it by that. Love that shit.
Yeah, and actually, that's all hoopla to get you to try to. It's funny, we think that how that like implies something is going to happen, but it's each spin is so unique that
definitely
yeah. it has no play on the other one.
I think
but it seems like fuck a number if it keeps coming up red that eventually it's going to hit a black one.
17, man, that's my number.
Yeah, I got all sorts
17.
Of
17. Come on, 17.
It's at the end when you just put a bunch of money down on one number and hope for the best.
For sure, man.
Fucking
I've had many, many nights playing roulette, though, to where the equations worked out for me as well, and I've sat there for a couple hours and maybe only walked away at, like, you know, $30-$40 ahead or losing, but I've had, like, 5 or 6 beers, 7 beers, too, so it's all good.
Yeah, that's the way to do it. The poker room, poker was one of my old fascinations too. Like I used to do the poker tournaments out at Saquon and Viejas all the time.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
That shit was fun. I won one of them while I was out there one time, and Fox News was there. Dude, like it was like right like sort of the poker boom era or whatever, and they were doing like, just like a story to try to get people out there playing cards. And I got to win the tournament. I happened to win in the tournament that time and did like a full like Fox interview. I wanted to try to see if that shit was online or not, but it was like, you know, before the news was putting every news story online or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's cool, man. So I remember I used to play poker all the time. Like back, like when I moved out to San Diego and I was taking a break from everything, it was pool and poker. Those were the two things, like, me and everybody I worked with, we'd go and shoot pool, like, 3, 4, 5 times a week, and then sometimes we'd have, like, poker tournaments. It was back when, Texas Hold'em was super big.
Yeah.
So.
Are you good at pool?
I used to be fucking... I guess I was good. I don't know. There was a time where I was going to start joining a league because I had jumped in. I'd like filled in for people on leagues, and I was really good at where I played. Like there's a bar in La Mesa called the Hearth House that we used to go to all the fucking time. And I knew those tables like intimately. And then there was another place, Jolton Joe's, in La Mesa as well.
I used to play at Jolton Joe's.
Yeah, and they're bigger tables. They're more like regulation tables. But, like, we'd play at those places, and then there's another place called On Cue in La Mesa. So those were, like, the trifecta of places. But the Hearth House, which they had the little bar tables, and they rolled fucking weird. Like, the one in the back... where it had a bathroom that leaked all the time. There was, if you broke the balls in a certain way, the bumpers were a little bit low on that side of the table. So you could hop the ball off the table, which is not a good thing to know unless you're playing against somebody that's being an asshole and they just stand behind the rack and you just want to, you know, fucking scare the shit out of them. So there was one guy that was like a big asshole while we were playing there all the time. And, you know, he wanted me to break the balls, and I was like, all right. And, you know, it was basically all you have to do is just do a straight shot right towards the cube or the head ball on the rack. And, you know, depending on how you aim it on that head ball, it would pop, like, just right off the table. And he was standing right behind the rack, so I just fucking broke it, and it the ball flew right in his nuts. And
put one on him.
Yeah, I was like, I had no idea that was going to happen to your balls right there. But I'm so glad it did.
Yeah, people don't understand etiquette these days.
Yeah. So, and it's fine. I mean, I don't mind it. It's just those guys were so fucking annoying for so many other reasons that, you know, it was just an opportunity. Because when you play in a bar, you expect people to be jumping around, dancing in front of your shot, and, you know, just doing stupid shit. And that I loved playing at that bar because I knew those tables and I knew how fast they were, how slow they were, and all that kind of shit. Plus, the bartenders were cool and they always hooked it up. It's like the strongest. If you want the strongest, best drinks in San Diego, you go to the Hearth House. As far as I'm concerned, it's like a little hole in the wall bar. They've fancied it up a little bit and their prices have gone up in the last 10 years. But it's fucking still they rock you hard. Pour some sugar.
I can attest to that, dude. Best bar in La Mesa for sure, by far.
I'll give him a shot. I just drank a big vodka drink. Is it okay if I go take a pee break?
Actually, I really need to take a leak too. So let's take a little break, Justin. If you need to take a little pee pee, now's the time. I don't have any music.
Synchronated urination.
Yeah.
And go.
Everybody listening live, we'll be right back after these messages from Nothing. Say hello to Nothing.
Tell them. Can you play a song at least?
Yeah, I can play a song.
Should we talk some Death Squad stuff? I just made a poster for Rogan.
Fuck yeah, man.
Show.
let's talk about some Death Squad stuff, because that's
How did you get hooked up with Joe in the first place, man? Just a fan of your work from beforehand, or how'd that connection come about?
I think it was through connecting with Ari first, because I heard you guys just went and saw Ari at the Comedy Store for the first time, right?
Fuck, we did, yeah. Fucking awesome, man. That was, 2 weeks ago now, Ray?
420.
That's right.
We saw... He was Freddie and Tony Lockhart.
Tony,
fucking hilarious, man. Tony was a total surprise, man. I didn't know about Tony Hinchcliffe until that night, and that dude is fucking – he almost stole the show for me personally. That guy was just a fucking maniac. But they're all hilarious.
He's a total sweetheart too, like the nicest guy you could think to meet. Like that persona that you see, like his comedic persona and like how he acts, how he is on podcasts, like he's that genuine, like – nice guy.
I think that's how most people are. I don't know. I don't really have that kind of experience, at least meeting people from that do podcasts. But I think, like, if you were to gauge somebody, like, how they are in real life, like, listening to a podcast they do or whatever, is definitely the bong hit you need to really take in who somebody is.
Yeah, it really gets down to the, down to the brass tacks of it
for sure. Yes, that was hilarious, and it was my first live comedy show that I've ever been to, which I feel somewhat ashamed admitting that, especially like being a fan of Death Squad for however long. I saw the first Joe Rogan Experience with the Snowflakes. I remember seeing that and I was like, boom. And then addictions from there. But I don't know, for whatever reason, haven't seen the comedy shows. And I was super excited. Like, I talked about this, I think it was the last podcast we did. I was, like, super fucking excited. And I haven't been that excited for anything, like, in a long time. Like, I was super, like, child on Christmas to go watch this show. And it was fucking amazing. I enjoyed the fuck out of it. So you started with, I think I heard... I don't know if it was the first podcast you did with them, but I heard your podcast with, I think it was all three of those guys.
The first one I did with the Death Squad guys was with, Sam Tripoli, Jason Tebow, and, Tony Hinchcliffe was there. Like, I think that was the first podcast I did with them.
The first one I listened to.
My sister has worked at the Comedy Store in La Jolla for like 10 years now or something crazy. So she ended up, Ari got me some tickets to the last time Joe played the House of Blues down here, mm-hmm. and ended up getting me a ticket to, the UFC in Vegas when Uriah and Dominic Cruz fought.
Nice.
So sort of, we had just, because he's good friends with my sister or whatever, I started going to the shows and like, I ended up doing the show poster for him, It ended up being him, Freddie Lockhart, and Tony Hinchcliffe for one of the shows they did here in San Diego.
Ari Shaffir?
Yeah, Ari. Okay, Ari, Freddie, and Tony, was last year they did a show at the Comedy Store.
I think that was that podcast, because you did a podcast with all three of those guys, right?
Well, I did, but later on, that particular show, I think I did a podcast with Ari by himself at the Comedy Store.
Okay.
But maybe not, no, because he was with Steve. At some point, I recorded with those three guys, but I also did a podcast with Ari by himself as well.
Nice. Yeah, I think at least the first time I heard your podcast was the Ari, Freddie Lockhart, and Tony Hinchcliffe podcast.
Yeah, the one of us getting high together is seriously, although the sound quality is pretty shitty, like, it's really one of my favorites. It's really fucking funny.
Yeah, it's awesome. I mean, fucking any podcast where you're having fun and you have a sustained conversation, even doesn't matter how ridiculous it is, it's like, it's enjoyable to listen to. That's what, at least for me, those are the type of podcasts that I like listening to. So it's like, I don't know. I don't know which podcast you listen to, but for me, like, the Bone Zone are really funny. Fucking all the Death Squad ones are super hilarious. But it's like, there's some where they don't have a format, they don't have a plan. Like Joe Rogan, all those things. Those are my favorite things to listen to. But I don't know. I guess I like some that have a specific format too. But so you did the poster for them and
And then I met Joey Diaz at some point. He was doing shows down here, and we met after one of the shows and connected. And we sort of built a little bit of a bond before I became more friends with Joey than I did with the rest of those guys first. Like,
wow.
We had some sort of connection, and then Joe saw my stuff that I had done for Ari.
Yeah.
And then Red Band had me do some shit for him. Like, I helped him vectorize his logo, and I did some shit for him or whatever.
That's awesome.
So,
I know that. Yeah, it's fucking awesome.
Yeah, just to, like, clean it up or whatever. Like, it's the same thing, but
yeah.
So like, and the Red Band was on the podcast before too, and we connected sort of like we did a sort of art based podcast,
yeah.
Which I don't know if a lot of people know how much he's into painting, or which isn't that much now, but yeah. At a time. And I guess I've been trying to get Joe to do the podcast, but he ducks me when I try to get him to sit down for an hour. But apparently, he used to draw all the time too.
Yeah, really? No. I've seen some of his work. I think you should try and be on his show. I think.
Well, I've done the Ice House shows.
Yeah. Well, I saw that one. Like,
that's a little less intimate.
Yeah, totally. I think, I don't know. Like, I can understand. I don't know. It's kind of a weird dynamic, especially with podcasting, like who's going on whose show and stuff like that. But I can see. I don't see why he wouldn't have you on his show. I think it would be a good conversation, you know. So I don't know. Him going on other shows is like, I don't know. It seems like it would be more effort for him to go on somebody else's show because he's like focused on what he's doing, you know.
Yeah, dude's hyper busy, so I don't take it personally.
Oh yeah, for sure. But totally sick. So so you met Joey Diaz, Joey Coco Diaz, and
he's the best.
He is the most like dynamic got personality in all those guys, and like so down. He seems so fucking down.
Super genuine, man. Like, he came more genuine than fucking Coco Diaz, man.
Yeah,
he is. He's seriously like one of my most favorite people in the world. Like, we connected at one point. Like, I don't think I've told this. I don't know if I've told this story. I don't think I have on any of the podcasts. But a little over a year ago, maybe a year and a half now, my stepfather died from cancer. Mm-hmm. And at the moment, like it was within the week that he had passed away, Joey had done a podcast or it was one of his blogs or something talking about his mom. And something that he said like really resonated with me and sort of helped me get through that sort of mourning phase at that. Like I just heard something that I needed to hear, you know, and it something struck me or whatever. And at some point in the story, he was talking about how when his mom played pool at her bar, she would paint the quarters that she used red, like either with nail polish or with like some paint or something, so that she could see where the quarters went. Or I'm not exactly sure why she did it. But the day I heard that story, I was at a taco shop and I got a burrito or whatever. And the change that I got back, I got a quarter that was like from the year before she died. Mm-hmm. And it was all red. But like worn down red, like so like the face of George Washington wasn't red anymore. It was just the bottom part of it, like the most carved out.
Yeah.
And so like we had this weird kid, like I told him the story, it shocked me when it happened. Like, wow, that's fucking crazy. And you know, it could all be coincidental, but it was like it all sort of happened at this very sort of momentous moment. And in sharing the story with him, I guess we sort of bonded in some way. Yeah. Like, you know, like we knew we were alike. And then, you know, I guess he talked to the guys about me at some point and, you know, we just became friends from there. Became, you know, like-minded people, I guess.
Fuck
yeah. But it's kind of weird. Like a year ago, I was talking with this kid, John Hanlon, mm-hmm. who listens to my podcast. Like from the get-go, he was one of my first listeners, I think. And we were just talking like how crazy it'd be to go on one of those fucking podcasts, right?
Yeah.
And then like a year later, I was sitting in the Ice House, and it was very strange. Like, And not like I was like aiming to do that, but it was like, hey, there's this weird fucking situation that has arose over just doing what it is that I do, you know?
Yeah. No, for me, that was like, it was insane for the Ice House Chronicles situation. It was like, I saw your tweets. It's like, I'm going to head up to LA or whatever. I think you were, it was something to do with the posters or the prints that you were putting together. And
yeah, that was for, I did some stuff for Joe's Chicago show.
Yeah. And and next thing you know, I'm tuning in and you're sitting there on the table in you know, the Ice House, the back room of the Ice House, and fucking it was crazy. It was like, I don't know, like, how nervous were you when you went to sit in on that?
Well, it's still, dude, like, I get nervous even doing my podcast, like, oh, starting, yeah, this thing, like. And still, like, until that first, like, 10 minutes goes by,
yep,
like, the heart rate is up, you, yep, know, your adrenaline's pumping a little bit for just some weird reason because you're being recorded, and particularly going live, too. Like,
yeah.
I have some comfort in recording my podcast and being, knowing I have the opportunity to go back and edit my silliness or whatever if I say something nonsensical.
Yeah, for sure. Even for, like, I feel the same fucking way. And for me, it ramps up the minute, because every time I put together some new intro or whatever before our, like, standard intro, like, whenever I hit play on that, like, my heartbeat goes pop, 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 pop. And yeah. I'm like, oh, this is happening right now. And it doesn't matter who. It could just be me and Justin. It could be me and you. It could be me and fucking Keith Spurlock One. It could be me and whoever we're having on the show. It's like I had this ramp of adrenaline and I can feel it, like, pumping through. That's why
it's fun.
Yeah, it is fun.
And that rush is great. That's I enjoy that in every, like, you know, like I said, at golf, like, you get that right when you're on the first tee, like, all of a sudden, like, the world depends on what happens, yeah, next, you know?
I used to get that when I'd play basketball and we were down, and it's like I had a really good shot. I had a really good range. So, like, throwing down threes was big. So, like, I would feed on that, like, that adrenaline. And I'd also feed on the shit talking. So it'd be like, you know, I'd be going down the court and somebody would be defending me and they'd be like talking shit the whole time. And I'd be like, pull up for a quick three and sink it. And then it just feeds on itself. And that's the same thing. Like, when I do this shit, I do the intro, do the thing, and then we start talking. It's like once we start talking, it's not stressful at all. It's just having a conversation. And it's, you know, it's, I'm not thinking about all the other things except for, you know, the technical things that are going on.
Yeah. And I mean, like, that said, you know, sitting down at the table and having Joe Rogan sitting, yeah, across from you,
yeah,
then, you know, Felicia Michaels sitting to your left and whoever else, there's somebody else there, I think, I forget who, but
yeah,
you know, like, I grew up, like, I watched news radio religiously.
So did I. Yep. Yep.
Like, it was great. And obviously I've been watching fighting for a really long time. So I've been a fan of Joe's for long before the podcast or, you know.
I was a fan of Joe's long before I knew he did stand-up comedy. Like, a fucking huge fan of news radio, huge fan of Fear Factor, huge fan of UFC. And then all of a sudden I get Netflix and I see he has a comedy special. I'm like, what the fuck? And I play it and it's like, okay, this is my shit. Like, this, everything communicates to me. I remember I had a job as a projectionist at a movie theater before I moved out to San Diego, and I had a little old school, like, old school, like, handheld TV that, like, worked off an antenna. It was like little, it was like mini projector, like, on a 1-inch screen on this little handheld device. And I used to watch, Fear Factor on that while I'm threading up projectors between sets. And it was like, so, like, just the person that Joe Rogan is, I wasn't fully aware of until he started doing the podcast. And then you really get in depth with somebody. And then once you get super in depth with somebody from listening to their podcast, listening to them on other podcasts and things like that, it's like you have a secret. And then when you go to meet them, it's like, you don't know what to do because you have this secret. You have this, like, all this information about this person. They know nothing about you. And it's like, you know.
Facebook and just the internet in general is the same way. Like,
yeah.
Beyond celebrity, like, you know, I joke sometimes, like, going to a party with my old friends, you try to talk about what you've been up to. Like, yeah. That typical, like, oh, hey, how you doing? What you been up to?
Yeah.
And you sort of, like, list off all the things that you've already posted on your Facebook that everybody's already read already, you know? Like, you're living in the past, or your stories are already old.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, it's weird. But it's weird when somebody knows all of your stories.
Yeah, it definitely, there's a different dynamic when everybody knows you and you don't know them.
Yeah.
Like, it's very strange. And, like even in the art world, there's this girl that does a blog called Art From Behind, Kelly Grayson. She's a New York gallery owner and curator. Mm-hmm. And I basically have watched her life. She's very open and public about what her life is and what she does every day. Documents it all.
Yeah.
And like, I know her relationships, what her parents are like, what her family's like. And I saw her at this opening and I was going to go up and say hi, but, and then I realized, like, God, it feels so strange that I know so much about you, but you know nothing about me.
Yeah.
It feels like I would be kind of creepy talking to you.
That's exactly what I felt when we went to go see Ari Shaffir and, everybody else at the Ice House. Like, right when we walked in, first, I didn't know what the fuck we were doing. I bought the tickets online. I didn't know I had to go to the
studio. Before you go any further, next time you're going to the Comedy Store, just tell me and I'll get you set up. You won't have to worry about any of that nonsense.
Okay, cool. But anyway, I got the tickets online. I didn't know what the fuck I was doing. First time at a comedy show, all that shit. Bought the tickets online. We went through the line. I'm like, I don't know if this is the ticket to buy tickets or the line to buy tickets or this is the line when you already have tickets. And it's, you know, I didn't know. I was totally ignorant. We went in and then we walked right past the ticket, like, window. And I was like, oh, and we walked in and there's like Ari Shaffir and, Freddie Lockhart and Tony Hinchcliffe just having a conversation with themselves. And I walked in and instantly recognized them, like, oh, and here's the comedians we're going to be watching later. Not even thinking about the fact that I need to redeem my printed out ticket for actual tickets. And then plus just seeing them, I was like, you know, I listened to What's Good. I listened to fucking Skeptic Tank. I listened to that shit and I've heard them on, you know, Joe Rogan's shit. I've heard them on, you know, Ice House Chronicles, and Tony Hinchcliffe has been, you know, in and out of Ice House Chronicles, you know, just as a guest. And It was such a weird thing, even though, like, I know it's not a big thing, but just being in there and my first time in the situation, it was, like, so weird. And then even after the show, we walked out, I had to go take a leak after the show, and then...
Those bathrooms are intimate, huh?
Yeah, oh, they are. That's actually the most intimate setting, but that's not the place you want to be intimate, especially with other dudes. So I walk out, and then my girl bought me Ari Shaffir shirt, and she's like, he's really nice. Just, you know, he shook my hand and all this stuff. He's right over there if you want to talk to him. And he's, like, talking to, like, three other guys, and I was like, I don't want to just butt in and just like, oh, Death Squad, Skeptic Tank, yo, what's up, Ari Shaffir, let's smoke some weed.
I'll tell you what, like, and especially, like, those dudes are kind of weird anyway, like, sort of, like, as funny as it is that comedians are so extroverted on stage, they're pretty introverted off stage. Like, they're just as awkward as, like,
I know. That's why I, like, if it was me, I wouldn't want somebody doing that. And I was like, well, I don't want to interrupt them and talk.
Can I do a public service announcement like, Death Squad fans? Like,
let's do it right now.
After the Atlanta show, or, like, during the Atlanta show, everybody was sort of lined up outside. Mm-hmm. And people who just, like, yell, like, butthole Olive Garden, you know, just like that's what you say. Like, it's automatically kind of, like, it's sort of weird. It seems like that's sort of, like, because it's awkward to approach these people, like, because you know them so much.
Yeah.
Like, that sort of, that exchange of just, like, what you said, just, like, screaming, like,
yeah,
what's good, Death Squad? Like,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
it is. It's socially awkward, and it's not like the best of ways to like interact. But like at comedy shows, like after comedy shows, they want to interact with you. Like yeah. even though it seems awkward, like it's even okay to like interrupt, I think, because sometimes that's what happens. And even like I think you. This happens at art shows, like for artists a lot. They'll get stuck in the corner talking to one person the whole time and not intermingle, sort of because they feel like they don't want to be the ones that stop a conversation or something.
Yeah.
But you can do that after a comedy show. Like, that's what they stick around for. And, you know, like anybody, like they like that admiration too. I'm sorry if you can hear my dogs.
That's okay. Water right now. Well, that's totally all right. No, I totally understand.
The screaming butthole it's weird.
No, I know. Yeah, no, that wasn't my plan. It's not like I came out as like, I'm going to yell Death Squad, what's good at the end of it. But it's like, I had the thoughts of like a typical fan type of thing going through my head. And it's like, you know, but at the same time, I'm like, I have been in art shows and I know for me, I'm not like, you know, I'm fucking like, if somebody likes my shit or knows who I am, it's like, woo. You know, I don't know. I'm not used to meeting people that I don't know or people that know me that I don't know. It's very like a weird dynamic. So it's, I don't know. And I know how weird they are. I mean, Ari's talked about it a million times. He's not even like used to selling his merch after a show. So, you know, I didn't feel it necessary to go up and talk to those guys. I felt, you know, it's like, whatever. If they're in a conversation, I don't want to be rude. And
well, that's like, dude, Rogan stays after almost, as far as all the shows that I've gone to, he stays after and takes the time to shake every single person that is willing to wait around and say hello and take a picture. That's what's so cool. I want to urge more comedians to hire artists to do posters, because that's a good way to sort of break that weird ice is, hey, I got this thing that is about you that you could sign. And while you're signing, we could take a photo and I could say a couple things and move on. Like, it's a cool way for them to interact after a show if they have that opportunity.
For sure. Yeah. Definitely. I mean, anything to like kind of break the ice is definitely a good thing. And if any comedians want to hire me, that's, you know, I'm for sale.
Yeah. Trying to break that market, man. I swear, I'm getting more support from the comedy world than I am the normal fine art gallery world that I'm used to. It's very strange.
That's the thing, man. It's like,
but I'm hyper appreciative. Like, I'm so stoked that it's working that way.
I don't know. As it's like, it doesn't matter where people notice your shit from. It's like, it's just about people like appreciating, you know, and it's awesome. Like, I'm sure those guys give you carte blanche as far as what you want to do for the most. I don't know. I don't know if they have rules. I mean, funny. I've done like, I don't know. That's I had a little graphic design business that I had back in the day, and I hated it. I hated having to answer to somebody that had an idea and their idea was bullshit, but I still had to deal with it. But I would assume those guys would be a little bit more lenient with, you know, like I've experienced like bands. Like I did a lot of like album artwork and album design for a band, and they were super like, do whatever the fuck you want to do. We're down. And, you know, those are the kind of people I like doing work with.
Comedians are pretty specific to what they want. And it's like, you know, a lot of times the weird thing is that when people are asking you to do art mm-hmm. who aren't necessarily aware of all the aspects that go into making it. It's like I posted a picture on Twitter of all the drawings that it took to make the Atlanta poster. Mm-hmm. Because I'm sure some people think that, like, I just scan a photo and do some little secret things in Photoshop and it looks like that, but really it's all hand done work.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, they allow me to do what it is that I do, but that doesn't mean that people who are paying for things aren't more apt to be involved in the creative process, which is weird. Like, that's part of the reason why I do painting full time as opposed to make a living in the graphic design. Not that I don't do graphic design and those sorts of things. Like, it helps pay the bills, but it's here and there, and, you know, stuff for people that I like and stuff that I want to do, as opposed to like this job thing. But even then, like, doing commission work and doing, you know, stuff like this, like, it turns into kind of a job to make it happen. But
Yeah.
You know, it's, and that's not to take away all the positives, but it's a little different than me deciding what type of painting I'm going to make and when it'll be finished. When the whole thing is up to me, it's a little bit different.
So when you're doing these like posters for them, do you ever like just like throw them a curveball? Like, this is like this crazy idea I have for this poster that's going to be like totally different from every poster you've ever seen. It's going to blow your mind. Have you ever like thrown one of those at them?
Well, I put ideas out there. Like, for instance, the Atlanta poster was going to be like the Mayan sun disk.
Uh-huh.
It's like a bunch of like Death Squad stuff in like the calendar situation.
Uh-huh.
But it was niched pretty fast. And then like I did the Sam Tripoli's logo for the Naughty Show.
Uh-huh.
And the one I was trying to do was like a sports logo. Like, uh-huh. I just took the NS and started putting together like a typical like sports team logo. And it ended up looking like a swastika. So that shit got niched pretty quick.
Yeah.
So like, there's things that happen that don't quite make the fucking cut.
Yeah. It sucks, man. Well, it doesn't suck. I mean, it's fucking amazing, but at the same time,
you had mentioned. I saw you mention on Twitter that we had some. I mentioned about our fellow Twitter followers.
Yes.
It's two people that have been on my podcast, Jocelyn Duke and Seth Coombs.
I have no, and they follow me.
They follow you. That's what my Twitter tells me.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know who they are, but at the same
time.
One
guy is a Seth Coombs is a music critic.
Okay.
He used to work at City Beat.
Okay.
And then Jocelyn Duke is a artist that was out of San Diego, but now up in L.A.
I don't know, because a few years ago, before I moved into my condo, I lived in Hillcrest, and I lived in La Mesa, and I started Digital Art Design Associates .04, and I was like, I don't like graphic design, and I brought a buddy of mine in to help with that, and then I wanted to pursue my fine art, my painting, and at the same time, I needed to move, and just by chance, that was back when MySpace was big. Just by chance, there was an artist or somebody involved in the art community in San Diego sent me or posted a bulletin on MySpace saying that she had an apartment in her complex available, Jill Johnson, Super Jill. I don't know if you know who she is or more super. But she put together a lot of art shows and events in like the Hillcrest area. With artists and fashion people and models and music and all, like the whole kit and caboodle. So it was like a week before I realized that my shit was getting raised, so I needed to move, and I remembered seeing that bulletin post, so I moved in there, and I just totally started the dude that a friend of mine that I had brought in to help take care of like the web design and graphic design portion of what my business was going to ultimately be. He like was pissed the fuck off that he wasn't going to be working with me and that I was going to be focusing on painting, and we kind of went our separate ways. Like he helped me move in, and that day he like drunk left and walked away, and I haven't heard from him since. I got one email from him like a year ago, and I haven't really talked to him since.
Animosity?
I don't know. It's kind of weird. He's very similar to me. I mean, we're very much like brothers, but at the same time, I can understand his animosity and the fact that he... I can understand...
You should give him a call. Can we give him a call right now?
We could, but I'd have to look up his number, and I don't think that's going to happen. No.
It's a little late on a Sunday.
Yeah.
But you should reconnect, maybe.
I know. I do want to, and I think he might be living up in Northern California. I have no idea what he's up to, but he had his own issues, and the fact that what he did, I can understand, because of what he was going through, I can understand how he felt the way he felt, and... But at the same time, I was like, I need to pursue my art now, because it had been so many years. Like, I had there was a time, I think, in when I did most of my most recent stuff, which is probably like 4-5 years ago, where I was like, I had done like 7 paintings in like a week or two. And the biggest painting I did that in a week. And I was like, I was on a roll and I was firing at all cylinders, and all of a sudden I had to move. And I had started this other thing, and it's like, okay, I need somebody to take over this other thing so I could focus and ride the wave that I'm doing. And, you know, it kind of fizzled when I moved, and I'd been in some shows that, Jill had put on and sold some work. And I don't know, I met a lot of people, cause she lived right above me. She lived in the apartment. It was like a modified house in Hillcrest. And it was so fucking small. So, and I was trying to paint in this like really small area, and I was really trying to get into big pieces because I had just done my biggest piece, and I, you know, I love doing bigger like paintings, and it was always really hard to get back in the flow of what I was doing. And been in a few shows here and there, so I don't know who the fuck I know. Or who knows who I am, in San Diego. I haven't connected with a lot of people. There was some people, I was at, an event in, North Park, where Justin from he's worked for some local magazine or whatever. He wanted to do an article on, I just started doing the Billy Dallas show, which was like a fucking internet show where I was like this hillbilly redneck guy that wanted to be a roadie for Atmosphere. And, in that I had promoted the fact that Dado for Art was going to be at this show. So I went in as Billy Dallas in full character for the whole show. And it was like a street fair type of thing. So everybody that came up was like, oh, hey, how you doing? And I'm like, Billy, I'm in the character, and they're like, oh, this is amazing artwork. Like, I had a bunch of different shit, and it just did not work very well. But this one guy came up and he's like, oh, I want to do a thing for you on this magazine I work for. And he ended up doing it. He wanted a press release from me, and I was like, I don't know how the fuck to do that. And I got a hold of a friend that knew how to do that shit and kind of fell through. It didn't work out, but spelled my name wrong and all kinds of shit. I don't know. Anyway, so I don't know who knows me in San Diego. It's like, I had a very short lived, art career in San Diego. It was well received, but it was like, I didn't have the steam behind me. So I have no idea who those people are. I wish I did. I'd like to know them, and they can come on the podcast anytime.
It's a tough world out there. It's hard to scrap by.
It's kind of a weird, like, there's no right way to do anything. And that's one of the things that, you know, taking you back to Exit Through the Gift Shop, you know, even though it was a manufactured fame, in entertainment and art, sometimes that can work. Not that that's like what I'm at all ever would try to do, but I think putting yourself out there so people know who you are, and just being accessible to people, not just like the rich people and the people that can actually afford artwork. I think that means more than anything, you know, because with anything, you're trying to sell yourself as a brand. And I think it's important for people to care about the brand, whether it's your name or if you have something like I'm trying to do with Inspired Disorder. You know, I think it's important to not only like build your brand, but make your brand or who people think you are mean something. You know, I think that's something that means a lot more and will have a lot more, you know, life than anything you could do. Cause you can have ups and downs, but if somebody like believes in your brand or believes in what you stand for as a whole, then I think you can have people stay with you longer than if it's like, you know, a passing phase of, you know, who's hot, who's not, you know?
Well, that's why I started doing the podcast. I realized that I was never that big of a like a stage comedy fan. And still, to this day, I'm more interested in hearing comedians talk than I am mm-hmm. necessarily seeing their stage act. I enjoy it, but I feel like it's two different things. Mm-hmm. But starting a podcast that was strictly art-based, to for the most part, it's about, you know, 75% fine artists, that mostly full-time working artists that are on the show. I wanted people to learn about these personalities because I saw that the getting to learn about these comedians made their stage work even that much more interesting. Yeah. And I know that a lot of times when people are buying art, they're buying a sort of personality type. Mm-hmm. And if you're not like in the public eye all the time, or if you're not out in like the social scene, for artists, sometimes it's hard to get your personality out there. You know, it's obviously it's a lot easier with social media and shit now, but mm-hmm. even the interviews that the artists do on a regular basis are kind of fucking bland and boring. Like, I wanted something to get that got to the root of who these people were, and by doing the podcast, I'm hoping to share with, you know, their both my collector base and their collector base what these people are actually like if they don't I have that opportunity to get to know them, you know, which in the fine art world particularly,
yeah,
it's like this shadowy presence of the artist that you don't ever get to know. But, and some of that, I'm sure part of that is the allure of fine art as well. But for me, I wanted to hear these people's stories and see what made them who they were, you know?
Yeah. I mean, we live in a space, in an environment where everybody wants to know the most intimate details about everything, you know? So, you know, it's not that podcasting is like reality TV, but it's definitely more informative than reality TV would ever be.
Sure.
But I totally, like, when we started this podcast, you know, 3 years ago, I really wanted it to be art focused, but at the same time, most of the discussions would be focused on tech. So it was an art slash geek culture podcast, and primarily it would be like whatever tech news or geek news would be showing up, and then we'd put in, I try to put in, you know, an art conversation, but it's really hard. When, you know, it's really weird gear to change between like technology and art, even though there's a blurring between the two, somebody that's super into tech and somebody that's into art, it's very hard marriage to combine for, you know, a conversation for a podcast. So when I started it up again, I was like, I just want to fucking have conversations with people. I don't really give a fuck. It doesn't have to be about me. It doesn't have to be about art. It doesn't have to be about anything. I just enjoy listening to people have intelligent conversations with each other. And I think if you have intelligent conversations with interesting people, then that in itself will just grow into whatever it becomes. Like,
yeah, and sure, that's the thing with my show too, is like it's not necessarily about art, but sort of what the person is behind it. Like, and I always have found painters particularly to be super interesting. They're always, it's funny, the connections between comedians, painters, and like strippers are, it's porn stars, porn really stars. Fucking close, man. It's very strange.
They're all fucking like side outcasts, like fucking weird introverts that just wallow in their own existence.
But there's a dominance level too that's sort of more introvert, I see.
Yeah.
It being as like even like a stripper has balls to get up and take her fucking clothes off and dance around for a bunch of fucking knucklehead ass fools. Like,
and they may
to
actually
me, that's
get,
like strength.
They may actually get more money if they go up on stage and show some balls when nobody's expecting it.
I don't know. That might turn
that's
business
true.
Away. I don't
that's
know
true.
If that's gonna
I don't know
money.
Either. Well, I guess it depends where the strip bar is, but yeah, no, it's like you're a little fucking sheltered geek and you're like, I'm going to create something that people are going to appreciate and notice me. And that's like this, that's what those people are doing. They're like in their little room, in their little brains, not little brains, but in their brains. And
I kind of, to be totally honest with you, I kind of feel like that sort of stereotype is a little bit misconstruing.
Like, of what?
Like the idea of the artist being like. Oftentimes, I feel like it gets lumped in with like the sort of comic book nerd sort of stereotype.
Yeah.
Of being like picked on in school, like. Nobody picked on me in school, but I've been artistic my whole life. I may like have been more sensitive to different things, but like I wasn't like, you know, like I've always like a lot of painters, particularly painters, are like outgoing. And like I grew up around, like really came into things being around graffiti writers, and graffiti writers have one of the biggest bravados. That's you know, true. Like this like humongous ego that they have to protect all the time, which. Yeah. I'm just as enamored with. So there's like this level. For me, there's this level of dominance, like the idea of like Picasso or somebody who's like, you know, like grabbing bitches off the street or something. You know, just like a like hyper dominant alpha male. More like I see painters more in that aspect than I do like the stereotypical comic book nerd. Just from my point of view.
Yeah. No. I've known. I definitely know people that are like that, but for me, I mean, I don't know. For me, I was fucking like, I didn't talk to anybody. I got picked on all the time. I just wanted to play basketball during like all the breaks in high school. And then I carry around I had my basketball and my portfolio. And then I'd like walk around school. And I was a weird dude. Cause I liked to play basketball before class, during break, at lunch, last break. And then I had like art classes. I don't know. It's very rare to find people that had the same like viewpoint as myself. But that was in high school. It's like in the real world, it's like you realize that there's so many people. Like there's people that were the people that made fun of the geeks and whatever, but they deep down they have this desire to be creative. Like
Both. I take back my bravado style. Like it's both. It's all types of different personality traits. Oh, for sure. Really.
Yeah. Oh, well, I mean, that's the whole thing. It's like you can never, there's no one cookie cutter thing for anything. And that's a good thing that you're not the same stereotypical like story, but, you know, it's crazy to see people that have never like, felt they were creative when they first realized they're doing something creative. Like it's an amazing feeling to see somebody realize that within themselves.
Yeah, like that revelation.
Yeah. And you know, it's super inspirational to me that when you see just like regular, it's so many people. It's one of the most annoying things for me anyway, is I'll meet somebody new or whatever, and they find out I'm an artist or whatever, and they want to show me their artwork, which is awesome. I love seeing anybody's artwork. I love seeing artwork. It's very inspirational. I just like seeing where they're at, and I like seeing what other people create. But then at the same time, they're very like hesitant to show that to somebody that's an artist. You know, they're very hesitant to let that part of themselves out.
That's all insecurity, though. Like that's all just not being comfortable with yourself. And if that's the case, if you feel like you're insecure about something, you got to sort of figure out what that is on your own. It's not about the actual act of sharing what it is that you do. Like obviously, it's a personal thing. But when you're totally comfortable with the work that you make, even if you're like 90% comfortable with the work that you'll make, you'll just show it. Like. I've been embarrassed by a ton of things that I've made in the past, like looking back, you know, a year later, but it's like big deal. You learn from that shit. Like over the last 10 years, I would have no sort of qualms about sharing stuff, but also like, again, it's the different personality traits. Like there's certain artists that don't want to sell their work because they feel like they have some sort of attachment to it.
Yeah.
But that, again, that goes back to just having sort of attachments to these things that you're trying to hold as tight as possible. But, you know, for somebody like me, like I'm making stuff all the time. Like doesn't make any, like it should be the creative process and the creation of the thing that's most important. Like after it's done, like it's done. You've already worked out what it is you need to work out. You should move on to the next phase.
Yeah.
But I think you just got it. if you're not confident with yourself, go back to the drawing board. Go look at what you're doing. If you think that it's not good enough, then there's a reason why you feel that way. You know, you can't just change and be the best overnight. Like, you got to put in the hours and work. Like, I made hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of shitty paintings that are out there in the world before I could figure out, you know, and I liked every one and got something out of each one along the way. But, you know, in, if you compare it to the work that I do now, it looks shitty, you know?
Yeah. No, it's a learning process, you know?
It's and, a evolution, you know? You got to evolve. You got to, you know, your skills have to develop and, you know, just, you know, if you stay the same, if you stay stagnant, you know, you're going to fade away eventually. That's what basically fucking everything in life, so.
But that is a weird thing, though, sharing your work with another, particularly if the artist is respects your work or your opinion, like, shit could get weird.
Yeah.
I get that. I used to run a gallery downtown for a few years, and I curated and got submission after submission that was just horrible. Like, people would come in and show me their shit, and I would, you know, and like, most of the time it wouldn't be good enough to show in the gallery. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, like, I would, if I look at something and I know that people are putting their heart and soul into it, or really like doing it with the right intention, I'll find, even if I don't like the work, I could find something in it that I can appreciate a quality in. Like, there's songs that I do not like and have no interest in listening to, but that I could still respect the quality of craftsmanship of a song, or, you know, of anything, really. It's something that somebody put their effort into. So, like, I always try to, you know, one of the dudes I did, that dude Seth Combs that I mentioned, he was always shitting on, like, how people shit, that people are sucky at art or something, that you need to let them know. Uh-huh. But for me, it's like, if you're getting something out of it, who am I to fucking tell you what is supposed to be what? Like, this shit is about no rules for me. And for me to pretend like you should have some sort of set of rules that guides what you do is silly. But, you know, you'll be able to test based on your crowd, like the people who like your work, whether it's, you know, marketable. That's one thing. But, you know, if you, that shouldn't be your number one focus. If you're making things, it should be about that creation process and the benefits you get in that, like focusing on that period of time. And then, you know, if you're able to focus on that, typically, you know, let the powers that be guide the work after that. And typically the work will sell itself, or you'll find yourself in the particular art niche that you like, or, you know, you'll find yourself with like-minded people. Like, that's how it's always worked for me. Like, I didn't try to go get a job with Shepherd Fairey. Like, it just sort of had a natural progression. Like, I didn't really try to meet all the Death Squad guys. It just sort of naturally progressed that we became friends and worked together or whatever. So it's like, if you put in the work, and, you know, it's like that real recognize real, or whatever the fucking hip hop phrase is, like that sort of shit. Like, if you go in with the right intentions, you're gonna attract the like-minded people, just like everybody sees sort of with this whole Death Squad movement situation. Like, and I say situation just because of jiu-jitsu. I know I've said it like 100 times already. It's like it's a Portuguese thing. I say it all the time.
Situation is a Portuguese thing?
Yeah, well, jiu-jitsu guys always say in particular situations. It's an overused word, and it's just part of my vernacular now. But, oh, clearly overused vernacular.
Well, that's a good situation. But, I mean, seriously,
if you, with the right intentions, you know, all those things come afterwards as a natural progression of the progress that you put in, like the work that you put in.
I think, definitely.
I think the most important thing is to do what you enjoy doing, first off, because any input you get is adding something to, you know, is adding something to cloud your vision of what you want to do. But also, it's like, you know, you have to let things happen organically. You can't force anything. Like, somebody who puts a video together intentionally to be viral is not going to be as successful as somebody that just puts something together because they fucking enjoy it. Yeah, there's a few examples that shit goes crazy and, like, somebody fakes something and it goes viral. But in general, in reality, the things that become successful, not only just become successful, but sustain their success or sustain their power, are things that are created organically, created from the heart, created like, because that person puts every piece of themselves into it.
And that if you do it the other way, like you said, like this idea of trying to make a video go viral, one, you're setting yourself up for failure already because you're trying to predict the future of what's going to happen. And then when that future doesn't happen, you're going to find yourself in this like state of depression because you failed at what you had predicted what reality really is.
Because you had thought you knew the formula for success and you were wrong. Yeah. And, you know, I actually listened to one of your last podcasts, and I forget who the fuck it was with.
With Blaine?
Yeah. And he spoke about something that is very similar to how I feel about, at least more recently, how I feel with any project that or not just any project that I work on, but just with any small thing that I work on, I basically use that idea or that concept as a seed. And I let that seed just germinate either within my brain or within, you know, a canvas or within, you know, wherever space is going to be growing. And I let that germinate and I just put it out there and I let it grow and I let it grow and I let it change organically depending on, you know, the environment it grows in and just how my brain adapts to what situation it's being put in. So it's like if I have an idea for a painting, the idea I have for a painting is nothing. It has some resemblance to the finished product, but in no way do I know what the fuck it's going to turn out to when it starts as an idea. And that I just kind of imply that I just kind of like put that mindset to almost anything. Like if I'm working on any, like if I need to come up with an idea for some new project or some new thing that I'm doing, it's like, okay, there's this thing that's going to be going on. And these are the attributes of that thing. And I'm just going to like put it in my brain and let it seed itself and let it grow. And then I'm going to organically see what comes out. Because if I know if it's put in my brain and it's something that I'm not necessarily always thinking about, but it's something that's in there, that through just the process of life, that's going to feed it. And it's going to come, like, there's going to be a point where I'm like, this is it. This is what the answer to that question that I put in my head like a week ago, this is the answer for the next step. And then the next step happens and then it like grows. And it's a very, like anything I do, anytime anybody asks me like, well, how did you come up with that idea? It's like, well, it's one of the most complicated things to answer because I start with this one idea that means slightly nothing compared to how it grow, what that idea grows into.
It's like asking, how did you win that chess match?
Yeah. And it's, you know, you have to, and I think that's the main goal or the main strength for somebody that's doing anything creative. And that might not be the only goal, but for me anyway, that's the goal, is trusting in my instincts to let an idea grow into something. And I know when I paint, it's by the end a lot of the times, or just sometimes in the process, I'm just so fucking sick and tired of looking at something. Sometimes you just know when it's time to like step away and let it go. And, you know, sometimes it's like you need to step away. You need to, like, sometimes you need to leave before you can come back.
Yeah.
So
that's why it's good to work on multiple things at once.
Exactly. So, yeah, anyway, that's my little...
I know you got a couple post office workers that are also podcasters mm-hmm. on your network, right?
Yeah, so Inspired Disorder Collective is a project I put together because I started doing this podcast again, and, you know, I started getting a lot of Death Squad listeners because in one of our episodes we talked about Monkey Todd and what happened when he went to, or at least our interpretation of what happened when he went to the Ice House Chronicles back.
Did you have him on the show?
No, I actually
almost had him on mine.
Yeah. I had talked to him and he listened to one of our shows, and then I had offered him, you know, if he wanted to come on our show, or I even offered him that I'd produce a podcast for him. And the next thing that happened was that he canceled his, or at least his Twitter and Facebook account, like went black. And then he showed up in LA and the Ice House Chronicles and all that stuff happened. And I'm like, well, maybe I kind of spoke a little bit too soon. But because I had talked about him prior and like in 3-episode span, it was like, oh, I started talking to Monkey Todd. Oh, and Monkey Todd listened to the episode. Oh, and Monkey Todd is on the Ice House Chronicles. And then kind of weird stuff happens. So, you know, but we gained a lot of Death Squad listeners because we talked about Monkey Todd and Death Squad. Yeah. But it's easy. It's like an organic thing. It's like we were going to talk about this shit anyway. And
did you see my I had some post office rants over the last, because I've been shipping Rogan posters, yeah, the Atlanta posters out for, yep, like 3 days straight.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
The post office is an amazing place. Like, seriously, if comedians run out of like material, they should just go there and hang out for like 2 hours.
Yeah.
It's seriously the funniest shit I've ever seen in my life.
Yes. Is it just the people that go in there? Is it the, dude, is it the customer service? Is it a little bit of everything? Like,
you know, like, you know how everyone thinks that post office people are all disgruntled and shit, like that they have bad attitudes? It's because they're bombarded with the most dumbass questions,
yeah,
that are asked by the most entitled assholes that I've ever seen. Like, you know, like everyone shows up with like the express, like the most, whatever the most expensive shipping box, yeah, is, and want the cheapest shipping and then bitch about it when they can't get it. Like, it was rad. There was these two ladies that came in full burkas, and like I could tell like everybody in the place was stressed, like the ladies were strapped with dynamite wrapped around, oh yeah, their the, waist the, or something, you know.
That's the instant stereotype. Yeah, I mean, that's what people, yeah, go, sure, to automatically, and we see, you know,
and
people,
no, people, you know, like, let's even beyond the stereotype, let's not pretend like if it was somebody with a big pink mohawk that everybody wouldn't also sort of be staring at them and have a little level of uncomfortableness, because it's something different. It's a different type of culture. And that's not to say that, yeah, everybody hates pink mohawks or whatever, you know what I mean? But what was really interesting, I was laughing in my head about all these people that were in there, like, you know, gawking at these ladies, like, that's not right. They people didn't want them to be covering their faces. But the one lady's sleeve, when she like picked her arm up to like do something or whatever, it literally looked like she had a vagina embroidered, like a vagina design embroidered on the sleeve of the undergarment under the burqa, which to me was like, it clearly, I doubt highly that it's a vagina, but it's like an like if I were to say, hey, will you draw me a little like quick design of a vagina,
yeah,
you know, like a vagina design, this is exactly what you would draw. And then it had like some little like decorative design around it. But I thought, how funny if this is actually like some sort of celebratory design of the vagina, yet coming from a culture that's so quick to oppress any sort of female sexuality, was like this weird dichotomy that I found hilarious. But among other things, there, like, there was this one like rich lady who sounded exactly like cracked out Whitney Houston.
Oh shit.
That just went on like a rant, and you know, just the people in there were so ridiculous. Some funny stories happened if you just hang out for a while and, yeah, are patient yourself. Cause I was going in, I knew I was going to be in there for an hour at least.
Yeah.
And so I just sat back and enjoyed the show, man. It's a hilarious place.
It is fucking crazy. It's almost like the DMV, because everybody at one point or another has to go in there. But yeah, so the Inspired Sword Collective I started, and Postal Poet, who does a Going Postal podcast, he did Ask My Boss and Keep Making Noise. He does a show, and he's a postal worker in Houston, Texas. And then Mish the Dish, who does Ramble On, she is from Boston, from Revere, Boston, and she's a postal worker as well. And
that voice on her is so great.
Yes, and it's hilarious because you hear Joe Rogan and his other guests, and they constantly make fun of the Revere women accent, and Mish the Dish has that, but she has the mentality of like a Duncan Trussell. So, like, instantly when I heard both of their stuff, it's like they're super creative. And, like, when I heard Postal Poet stuff, he's doing, like, different shit for sure. And then Mish was like, she does her own, her whole thing just talking into her phone in her car as she's doing stuff. And it's just like she can talk, and it's like super, it's like 20-30 minutes, but it's super addicting just to listen to her talk.
And I think knows so many words that she says, so many words that have R's in it. It's great. Yeah. I think every word that she says has an R in it.
Yeah, probably. I think that's like by law in Boston that you have to say that many, you have to have a sentence with so many R's in it.
I want to go there. I've never been.
Yeah, me either. The farthest I've ever been east is like Chicago, I think. And
Chicago's a great city. I fucking love that place.
But I was awesome. So fucking young, man. As an adult, I haven't really been. I've been up to Oregon. I've been to Hawaii a couple times and Vegas, but I really haven't done traveling as an adult. So, you know,
I want to go to Vegas for the heavyweight, for the Junior Dos Santos fight
against fucking Frank Mir.
Yeah, he's going to destroy Frank Mir, but there's going to be a whole ton of that's going to be crazy going at it,
because they're all heavyweights, right? Like the whole main card is heavyweights.
Yeah, it's going to be amazing.
It should be good. When is that? That's like late July, August?
I think it's in July sometime. Okay. I'm not sure when.
Yeah, that should be fucking crazy. I just hope I can get tickets for when I'm out there. We'll see. But, yeah, so they both do shows, and it's kind of weird that both of them are postal workers, and I don't know. It's basically people that listen to this podcast who talk to us on Twitter, because back when we used to do the podcast, we had a bunch of listeners, but nobody ever talked to us. And now that we're kind of in the zeitgeist of the Death Squad vein, we're getting a lot of Death Squad people, and a lot of them have started their own podcast. So I like decided to start a network for them, and I don't want to like limit it to where they can't release their shit. Like I don't want to confine it. So a lot of them, like Postal Poet and Izzy Rock, both of them have their own iTunes feeds. Mish the Dish just posted on SoundCloud, and I download it and re-upload it. So it's basically just a collection of people that listen to this show. And it's super inspiring to see what they're doing. Like, I don't know if Izzy Rock just started his Tales from the Hard Side, and it's like an interview type thing, like an Ari Shaffir type podcast. So far he did one where it was just him just kind of explaining what the show's going to be. And the second episode is him interviewing his mom, and he lives in, Ohio. And, it was like, it's like super deep, super emotional.
It's emotional, man.
I listened to it before I was going to work, and I was like getting choked up as I'm getting ready for work by like one of the stories they were talking about. And it's like, he's like a super real dude. And he goes, like, all of them are huge Death Squad fans. And it's kind of a crazy thing that's put together. And it's like, I don't know, it's like everything, it's I'm playing it by ear. It's like, this is this idea that I had, and I'm putting it together, and let's just see what happens kind of thing. And it totally inspires me, and I started doing my own podcast on the network, where it's basically I have a book of like creative writing, or poetry, some people would call it, but I just think it's more creative writing. And I started doing basically the audiobook version of that and I'm doing all the editing and everything, and I'm doing one piece at a time. So far I've done two, but I'm putting that up there. It's a pretty
amazing time period. Like, we literally, everyone has the opportunity to produce their own sort of network if they want to.
It's such an open access for anybody that wants to do anything. It's an amazing thing, the internet. It's an amazing thing. And I was talking to a buddy of mine that's a rapper, and I was talking to him about just releasing his shit for free as a podcast, like start his own podcast, and then each episode would be a song, and he could do an actual podcast if you want. But I don't know, I'm just trying to go fucking balls out with it and see what happens, you know?
Yeah, how interesting would that be to have a whole album that also has the artist talking about like how each track came about, exactly. Or like talk a little bit about it.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, like, he's a new up and coming artist, and it's a lot of them want to just release their shit for free. So what if you do a podcast where like an episode's a song, and then the next episode is just like you talking about your creative process, or maybe you get interviews. I don't know. I think what comedians are doing with, you know, Joe Rogan and Death Squad and all that stuff, I think that's a very intelligent business model or promotion model, or just like a different way to coagulate all the social media that you do into one thing that helps promote the one thing that you're trying to do and put out to the world, you know? So I think, you know, as you do with your podcast, I think that can in some ways apply to other mediums other than comedy.
Yeah, totally. Are you guys on the Rogan board?
No, I should be, but you know, I'm not.
All right.
Yeah. Sorry. Should I be? Okay. What?
You don't have to apologize.
No, but what are the advantages of being on the Rogan board? Like, other than connecting with people, what you're on the Rogan board, I'm assuming, right?
Yeah, I'm on the Rogan board. Okay, there's all kinds of great stuff. Like you get all the information before it actually hits the news. Like, it's funny, like news stories pop up on there mm-hmm. before, you know. It's like a group of people who are keeping track of like Reddit and, you know, all these different sort of sources of information, yeah. And then making it easily accessible. And then there's a lot of porn.
Well, that's the internet, right?
Yeah.
That's kind of what I use Twitter for.
For
that's
porn?
Kind of a good pace. No.
Well, you can do that though if you want, right?
You can, yeah.
There's a lot of porn stars on Twitter, right?
That's true.
There's a lot.
That's true. But there's websites on the internet that are good for porn too.
Yeah, I heard about those.
Yeah, they're free, some of them.
And are they free? Damn.
Yeah, there's some that are free, and there's some I guess you have to pay for, but I don't know who pays for porn nowadays.
Who would?
I know. The internet is the new woods, as Joe Rogan has said, and I can agree. It's funny. It's fucking hilarious. Like, I'd never known anybody to ever say this ever, except for my personal experience growing up, that kids find porn in the woods.
Dude, it happens. It happens.
And I grew up in a desert, okay? But there are tamarisk trees in the desert, and you go into those, and that's like a little mini woods. And sure enough, you find the small Mickey's bottles of malt liquor, and you find porn. And it's amazing. It's fucking astounding that's been the free porn route for more than just me.
But it's never, and when you find it in the woods, it's never like a full like magazine of porn. It's always like three pages that is sort of like
violently
mixed up,
ripped.
Like yeah, it's all like tattered from the weather. And then it's also like you get one page, and then you get like part of the next article or something.
Yeah.
So like, it was so difficult to acquire those things that in the olden days.
The
now
olden
it's
days. Now it's you. Type
it's
in.
Right? I remember Channel 99, man. I remember Channel 99 trying to get in on that little
scramble,
you know, the D scramble for those few
Spice
seconds. There.
I was just Spice. Listening to I've watched a little video clip of the Sublime documentary, The Stories Tells Lies and Exaggerations, mm-hmm. And the dude brought up a Spice reference. I was like, holy shit, that's fucking old as fuck.
Yeah, I remember Spice. I remember growing up, I had like antennas, and then I learned how to steal cable. Growing up, so like I stole cable,
crafty.
And then all of a sudden we had cable, and I remember, you know, you had those channels that were scrambled, but the audio was good. So that was like my first porn was like the audio of porn.
Yeah, and you can kind of see what was happening.
Yeah,
a little,
yeah.
Like pick out the shadows. It
that's
was like
why,
shadow porn.
That's why fucking American Pie was so hilarious, right? Because he's in his room watching a scrambled porn, and his dad catches him, and it's like
kids these days have no appreciation for that.
I know, they're like, why would I do that? I have a computer. But for our generation, because that came out, you know, in like 99, and that was, you know, that was so our generation of comedy, at least for me. I totally related to that thing, and it grew too, because there was another scene where they had the whole like Ustream chat thing. And apparently he he couldn't take the shit. But
that's right. I remember that part.
Yeah, dude, American Pie. At the time, I haven't watched it since then. I remember it being like one of my favorite things. And Road Trip came out with fucking Tom Green.
Those movies look old now.
I know, man. They're so dated all of a sudden. I know. It's like, what happened? Because I remember like when those first came out.
Like, the quality of film isn't as good. Like, it's just...
It's like 80s movies.
Yeah, it's like how 70s films look and shit.
Yeah.
I know, dude.
Fuck.
It's creepy. That means we're getting old. I know.
It's like... Yeah. It's like a lot of shit as far as lacking the appreciation that we had for it. It's like, look at, you know, kids watching cartoons nowadays, too. It's like they can just go to any, you know, Nickelodeon.com and watch whatever show they want, like, right away. It's like I remember having, like, waking up at 8 o'clock in the morning every Saturday, like, on the dot, if not way earlier sometimes, once it's like 6, just to watch, you know, G.I. Joe and Transformers and all that shit, you know. And it's like I said, kids nowadays, it's instantaneous. The internet's made everything instantaneous, so... It's like, I kind of feel sorry for those kids, though, because that was actually, like, the highlight of my week most of the time was, like, that Saturday morning coming up and those new episodes of those shows I wanted to watch coming up, you know? And it's like, what will these kids have now? It's like, they can look it up on their fucking phone right in their pocket in class if they want to, you know?
Yeah, it's pretty weird. It's, if you think about it, like, what happens in the next 20 years?
Fuck, yeah. Man.
Is this going to be beamed right into our cortex?
It seems like the only logical explanation, because this almost feels like... Too. Like, right now, it sort of feels like, even though we've gone through the phone phase, like, this feels almost like sort of telepathic communication. Yeah, like, we're in different parts of the city, you know, but having the very direct conversation and then blasting that out into the fucking universe.
Yeah.
That's just fucking insane. You never would have thought that shit.
Yeah. No, and the fact that we can do it and, like, for free. Like, we're doing this for free. And well, except for my internet connection, and you each have internet connections. Other than that standard service charge for your utility, which basically internet is a utility at this point, it's fucking insane. So if you look at your phone today and think of what your computer was like 10 years ago, you would laugh at the fact that you have more power in your phone today. I don't know what phone you have, Mike, but I'm assuming it's a smart one, and I'm assuming it's better than a computer you had 10 years ago.
Yeah, it's it is. It is. But I had one of those Macs that weighed like fucking 100 pounds, like that huge monitor with like the big egg shape coming out the back of it.
iMac.
Yep. Oh yeah, the original iMac.
Yeah, like that big fucking thing. I've always been. My mom does. She helps. She like. Takes care of the graphic design lab at Cuyamaca College. Uh-huh. And so I've always been, like, for as long as they've been available to me, I've always had computers around to do design and fuck around with. She's always been really good at them. So it's like I learned all that stuff pretty early. It's nice. I got lucky.
Yeah. Yeah, I started fucking Photoshop, like Photoshop 3.0. My mom had a Mac, like the old Mac. Damn. I think it was like
you go
a
back
Mac
to 3.0.
Yeah, before there were no layers. There were no layers. There were no like brushes. Were like fucking 6 brush types. But you could still go in and scan an image and cut it out and do some fucking crazy shit. And then
makes you respect those OGs who used to do design without any computers at all.
Oh, hell yeah, man.
I actually helped out. There was an old guy that used to come in to my day job, and he actually hired me to help him do business card designs for a garage. And he was like super old school. Like, he came in and showed me his whole portfolio, which is kind of weird. And it was all the old, like, you develop a picture, you cut it out, you fucking lay it out, you do all the measure. It's like all on a drafting board. And it's like what
layering
he wanted
different types of paper. Yeah.
And what he wanted to do, I did it in like 5 minutes. And the whole time he's looking over my shoulder. And, you know, that's one of my early introductions into why I didn't want to do graphic design.
You know, but, I think you'd asked me about school, and I took a ROP drafting class while I was still in high school. I was actually I had dropped out of high school and then did like the homeschooling to finish my senior year. And part of one of the things was was a drafting class, and I got a ton of good from that, like a ton of inspiration, like a sort of technical drawing skill. Mm-hmm. I didn't remember it until just now, until you started talking about that, like or until we started talking about this design.
Yeah.
But that was probably one of a real early influence that I didn't even think about until just now.
Yeah.
And are you guys going to Comic-Con?
Oh, fuck. Justin's gone. How many times have you gone, Justin?
I've gone, let me see, the past 5 years in a row. This year it sold out so fucking fast, though, man. I couldn't get a ticket in time. It sold out within like a few minutes this year. Yeah. So I just wasn't online at the time when it went down, and I got the short end of the stick. So no go this year. But
you know, there's always opportunities. Like, people don't realize, like, you can go down and, like, donate some work time, like donate like 4 hours of your day, and you can get a pass and go run around.
That's true. Yeah, I didn't think about that.
Or there's always sneaky ways to sneak in if you're.
Oh yeah. Well, actually, the past couple of years we've done the sneakiness, which you know, obviously I don't want to go into too much detail, but I know what you speak of, and it works. Well, it did work. I don't know if it works anymore now. They got some crazy shit going on. They got these new UV light scanners now for your badges. So your badges have like UV ink, you know, printed on them. So as you're walking around, you just get like a random UV light going across you. That was happening last year, and it kind of sketched me out for reasons I don't want to detail this evening.
I ate mushrooms there last year.
Oh shit.
Shit got weird.
Oh my, I can only imagine, man.
I couldn't deal. I had to get the fuck out of there.
Have you seen the documentary that Morgan Spurlock did?
I haven't seen that yet.
Just watched it last night. That's why I brought it up.
Nice. Yeah, I watched that like a few weeks ago. What did you think about it?
It was cool. It was funny.
Yeah.
I've been going for a little while. And, yeah. You know, I was trying to find myself in there.
That's cool. Yeah. Like, no. It's
a movie.
I think I've never gone, but I think he did a fair job at, like, you know, putting pins on the different people that go to the show or go to the Comic-Con, because yeah,
it's crazy, man. Yeah. It is a spectacle.
It is, man. It's unlike anything you've ever been to in your life. Like, it's unique by far. It's its own thing.
I'm gonna be selling some stuff down there this year. I'm sharing a booth with a friend of mine.
Nice. Awesome. Hell yeah.
Yeah. Artist where, Scott Saw.
Where can they find you? Is there like a directory or anything?
Yeah, there'll be. It's usually in, I think, like the 700 block. There's a section at the I guess it would be the east end of the convention center where most of the artists are at.
Uh-huh.
It's usually right by the G4 booth.
Okay.
Nice.
I know where that's at.
You know, it's pretty hectic, but it's always, there's a group of artists that are always around the same area. I'm trying to think, there's a toy company that's, something like some monkey toy company that is always right there. But yeah, I'll tweet it and shit.
Sweet.
For sure, man.
That's cool. So you've been there a few times. I mean, you went on mushrooms last year, but
yeah, there's a photo. If you go on my blog, if you go to mikemaxwellart.com and click on the blog and find the Comic-Con thing, I took a photo with this girl in a pink mushroom costume while like super high on mushrooms. It was right at the point I was about to get the fuck out of there, but it's a funny photo.
Nice. That's cool. Yeah. No, I've wanted to go, and I don't know. It's one of those fucking things, man. You know, I live in San Diego, but there's so many things that pass me by because I'm focused on other shit, and I always fucking miss. I used to go to the San Diego Film Festival back in the day, but I've always wanted to go to the Comic-Con, and I haven't been. So I saw the Morgan Spurlock documentary, and it seemed like a good representation of what is going on and things that I've heard from Justin and other people that have been there and how it's changed over the years. So
you could probably get a press pass.
Oh yeah. I don't know.
I think you're the media. You're the media.
Yeah, I am the media, right?
Yeah,
dude. Yeah, right. Hook that up and give me a pass.
Hook it out. I'll figure that shit out and I'll hook it up. And
that's doable.
Yeah, and I don't know, man. I'm totally down. So I guess
it's worth it, man. It's not just, you know, a lot of people have like the stereotype of a Comic-Con where it's all just nerds and like role playing World of Warcraft shit. You know, it's so far beyond that, man. It is. It's so hard to define now because it's just it's everything. It's like everything creative from every industry all just combined.
Yeah. And I know I've listened to like I used to listen to the Slash Filmcast, and which is a movie podcast, and they talk about Comic-Con a lot, and I know it's morphed into something other than comics because they talk about like fucking the vampire chick movie or fucking, you know, Lost, or they're talking about TV shows and movies. And it's like Hall H has become like the big monolith of fucking Comic-Con, but I know that beneath that there's a lot of like, you know, comic book shit. Fucking TRS has gone there. I know I wanted to go see TRS because they usually have a live panel and do their shit. But, you know, I don't know. Hopefully it'd be cool. It's like, I'll see. I'll look into that. See if I can get a press pass. I don't know. Yeah. I'll do it. I'll make it happen.
You got to meet Doug Benson, I see, Mike. I'm looking at your pictures right now, man. That's fucking awesome.
Yeah. He came by. I got a Woot Monkey.
Nice. Doug Benson might be in, or he is going to be in San Diego June or July. I think it's June. I'm going to try and go to that. Justin, if sure, you want to go.
Oh, you know I'm down.
All right.
I tried to get him on the podcast. He declined.
Really? Yeah. I haven't tried to get anybody that I listen to on the podcast. I've talked to people that I know that are doing things, and for the most part, it seems like the attitude I get is like, yeah, I'll help you out. And, you know, I don't want somebody on my show that's like, oh yeah, I understand that me being on your show is going to help you out. That's not my goal. So it's not like I'm asking.
Can we just cancel this thing then? Because that was the plan. Yeah.
Oh shit.
I was like, fuck, I'm going to do this dude a huge favor right now.
Yeah. No, I totally don't read your tweets. So if you sent that to me, yeah, I'll delete it.
I was going to say towards the middle of that, I'm like, well, you've listened to Mike.
But... I just want fucking people to come on and want to be on the show and like want to have fun and have a good conversation. And if it's somebody like there's somebody in particular that's like, yeah, I'll help you out. And it's like, all right, I'm going to focus on the people that actually want to be on the show rather than people that I'm trying to get a hold of that feel that they're doing me a favor by being on the show. So
yeah. Well, I'm lucky enough, like a lot of the people that I talk to have never been on a podcast before in their life, besides the few comedians that have been on, like the Death Squad people.
Yeah.
So, you know, like they don't even half the time they don't even know what the fuck it is.
Oh yeah. No, most people don't. That's what I said before. It's like you go up to most people on the street and you ask them if they know what a podcast is, they'll be like, eh. Most people barely know anything about computers, so let alone knowing about podcasts. So, but it, you know, it's like people I know, like friends or like, you know, but I don't know. It's not my thing to. I don't know. I don't know. I just fucking.
It's getting late. Should we call this thing? Can I go eat ice cream and get high?
Absolutely, yeah.
Absolutely.
Would
brother.
You like to go eat ice cream and get high right now?
I don't think I need permission, but I think I should pass since we're on the podcast.
No, fuck no. Yeah, we can end this shit. Mike Maxwell, where can everybody find your shit online, man?
Like I said, you can go check out MikeMaxwellArt.com, get all my information over there. There's a link to the podcast, the Live Free podcast. And then I'm on the Twitters, MikeMaxwellArt. And then I also have the Live Free podcast Twitter, which is at Live Free podcast.
Sweet. Justin King.
You can find my shit at jkdesigns.co. That is my portfolio / blog site. Also Twitter, Justin King 1. Number one at the end. That's me.
Sweet. You can find the Inspired Disorder podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Be sure to check out Inspired Disorder Collective on iTunes and Stitcher. Check out all my shit at inspiredsoda.com. Follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/RayTaylor. And thank you all for joining us for another amazing episode. With
yeah, man. Thanks for having me. Sorry to interrupt you. I just want to make sure I thank everybody who who's listening. Thank you guys for having me on the show. I appreciate all the support from you guys and all the Death Squad support. Like, it's super amazing. Like, I'm appreciative every day. Just so that's out there.
Fuck yeah.
Thanks for coming on, man.
Yeah, for sure.
Definitely an honor and a pleasure.
Anytime you want to come back on the show, let me know. And
yeah, I'd like to get you guys on my show too. Cross pollinate.
Done, sure, son. Man. That shit's gonna happen. I can't wait. I'm stoked, and I'm glad you came on. I can't wait to come on you to come on again. And
yeah, whenever. I'm down.
For sure. Because we're not done talking, motherfuckers. And thanks again. We love you all. Peace out.
Peace out.
Later.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Inspired Disorder Podcast. Embedded signals within this podcast have reprogrammed your natural thinking patterns. Side effects may include lack of inhibitions, erectile dysfunction, anal leakage, transcendental communication with beings from 4 of the 7 primary dimensions. In the event of a tear in space-time, please keep your hands down and feet together. Any loss of life or limbs due to interdimensional travel is not the responsibility of this podcast.